Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
John Conyers, Congressman. John Conyers spent a lifetime as a member of Congress. And despite his fall from grace, his time in office was deeply historic. He was one of the founders of the Congressional Black Caucus. He helped prepare and pass the Voting Rights Act. And he submitted almost every single year a bill in Congress to study reparations. But longtime Detroiters remember him as a young lawyer defending the black nationalist organization known as the Republic of New Africa after a shootout with police back in the 1960s. He was cool as cucumbers on ice, and he dressed with an impeccable sharpness. Historians Robin D.G. Kelly and Earl Lewis, in volume 2 of their book, To Make Our World Anew, A History of African Americans from 1880, wrote of Conyers' decades-long struggle to introduce reparations legislation, to further the work of black leaders such as Sojourner Truth and Callie House back in the 1880s, supporting the call for black reparations. Conyers did not prevail here, but he did struggle on for years. In recent years, charges of sexual improprieties were laid against him, which he denied. He resigned from Congress to protect his long, rich legacy. John Conyers lived through 90 summers before returning to his ancestors. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, at this time, Dennis Rodman, who's already becoming something of a wild card in the NBA and has had numerous post-NBA careers of dubious distinction, but he was frustrated. I mean, he did later on, when he was playing for Chicago, he did have the, I will call it a virtue, of saying during one of the games he was asked about playing the Utah Jazz when they were playing the Utah Jazz for championship. This was in the 90s. He said, well, what's it like playing in Utah? And he said, well, it's hard to concentrate with all these fucking Mormons around. And then he had to apologize, but I didn't think any apology was required.
Mexican officials say they've arrested 3 men in connection with Monday's attack on a Mormon family in which 9 members were killed. 3 women and 6 children died during an ambush on their vehicles by gunmen. The head of the Mexican security forces said the murders were a result of mistaken identity by a suspected drug cartel. 8 children who were caught up in the gunfire survived, including a 13-year-old boy who told his relatives that he'd hidden in bushes with his siblings, several of whom had bullet wounds, before they then walked 14 miles to get help. Leif Langford is a relative of one of the victims.
Our wives and our children left our town around 9:30 in the morning in 3 different vehicles. And just outside of town. They were ambushed by heavy gunfire to the extent that one of the vehicles exploded. We lost 9 and we have 4, maybe 5. I know 4 in the hospital. I believe it's 5. People were massacred. Christina jumped out of her vehicle, waving her arms at the cartel to stop shooting. And so we believe that's when they did stop shooting, when they probably realized it was women and children. There was no crossfire that they were caught up in. They may have been mistaken, their identity, but nevertheless, they were pure innocents, women and children, and 3 vehicles full of them going to weddings and going to see their husbands and their fathers and their families that they hadn't seen in a while.
Leif Langford, a relative of one of the victims of the gun attack in Mexico on a family of Mormons, and our Mexico correspondent Will Grant gave me the latest about what happened that day.
One of the children, certainly injured, walked for numerous kilometers to get back to the Mormon community and to reach safety. Really harrowing tales coming out all the time about this attack. For example, in one of the cars, one of the babies survived, and when help eventually arrived, they opened the doors of the car, obviously found the bodies of those who didn't survive, but the baby unharmed inside. You know, just an extraordinary event, even by the standards of Mexico's drug war.
Now, we're hearing different accounts as to why this family may have been targeted. On the government side seems to be saying that they weren't necessarily targeted for who they were, but the family and those close to them seem to have a different view.
Yeah, I mean, so the Mexican authorities are basically claiming that this was a case of mistaken identity, that there had been clashes and confrontation between 2 rival cartels, both splinters of bigger cartels, in the hours beforehand, and that the SUVs, the sports utility vehicles that the car, that the families were driving, were confused with the rival cartel, and that's why they're fired on. The families, as you say, dispute that. They say that they may well have been targeted because they were so vocal about cartel violence in the region, and particularly vocal about the traffic of arms from the US into the hands of the cartels. So, you know, I think that this is very early days in the investigation, and it will involve potentially cross-border cooperation, including the FBI and the Mexican authorities, to get to the heart of exactly what happened and why.
Will Grant.
4 decades ago.
All this week, we have been looking back at 40 years of Morning Edition through the lens of, among other things, politics, science, and culture. Today, we're taking a look at race and identity and how conversations about those things have and have not changed over the last 40 years. I'm joined by Maria Hinojosa, the host of Latino USA. Hi, Maria.
Hey there.
And Gene Denby, who's the co-host of NPR's Code Switch podcast. Hi, Gene.
Hey, Noel.
All right. So you guys, question to you both. 40 years of race and culture. There is a lot to
just
talk about there.
Just
where do you want to start?
A lot.
I mean, there's like a bewildering number of stories to tell about race, you know, flashpoints around policing, these tectonic cultural shifts like the rise of hip hop. We should probably just zero in on a few things that were making headlines in 1979 that we're still sort of grappling with today. Like back when Morning Edition was starting, you know, cities and counties all over the country were still trying to figure out how to do school integration. There were these big fights over busing. And it's safe to say that the anti-integration forces effectively won that fight. I mean, today, in 2019, American schools, by most measures, are more segregated now than they were in the 60s.
So there's something else that was going on. In 1980, the United States was about 83% white. Today, it's estimated about 72% white.
Hmm.
You know, some people call it the Browning of America. People who are part of that Browning, I don't know if they like that term, but that has been a central part of what's happened over these couple of decades.
So 40 years ago in 1979, Americans were getting ready to vote for president.
Mm-hmm.
How was race playing out at that point in that race?
Well, as Maria pointed out, the electorate was obviously much whiter than it is today. And Ronald Reagan was courting a much whiter mainstream. He famously, or infamously, depending on who you ask, gave a speech defending states' rights at the Neshoba County Fair in Mississippi. Neshoba County was about 7 miles from where 3 civil rights activists were killed in Mississippi.
I believe in states' rights, and I believe that we've distorted the balance of our government today.
That tape's a little fuzzy there, but he was talking about states' rights. And states' rights, of course, was a code word for segregationists. And he was speaking to anti-integration sentiment in the South.
You know, I think a lot of people forget that President Ronald Reagan put in place a blanket amnesty for undocumented immigrants way back in 1986.
I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here, even though sometime back they may have entered illegally.
Maria, that sounds extraordinary when you think about it today.
Well, this is a really fascinating conversation because, you know, if you think about the Republican Party now, it has won on an anti-immigrant build a wall. You know, immigrants and refugees are dangerous people. The Republican Party of Ronald Reagan and of George H.W. Bush was really a party that was saying, we think we could lock up the Latino vote. And one of the ways to do that was to be very open on immigration. George H.W. Bush, father, when he comes in, he actually ups the number of refugees, the opposite of what the Republican Party is doing now. And interestingly, then Bill Clinton comes in and was actually very anti-immigrant. There's this commercial where he comes out saying, you know, like, I'm going to take care of these illegal immigrants. I'm going to cut, you know, I'm going to come down hard.
President Clinton doubled border agents. 160,000 illegal immigrants and criminals deported. A record.
Bill Clinton, in many ways, was running to the right of President George H.W. Bush.
That's absolutely true. But, you know, something happens that really shifts the conversation around immigration, and that's September 11th. So, it would have been that George W. Bush and Mexican President Vicente Fox were about to sign this massive immigration legislation that would have, again, legalized so many people. It would have probably locked in the Latino vote for the Republican Party, except that September 11th happened.
And so we move forward a couple of years, mm-hmm. and we have this massive, 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 massive thing happen, which is this country elects a black president. And then everything's okay. I'm sorry.
If only. Things don't magically get better for people of color just because we have a black president. In fact, Obama's election in some ways might have elevated the sense of frustration for some people of color, especially black people. So a historian told me about this theory in social science. It's called the revolution of rising expectations. So in the 1960s, you get intense uprisings in inner cities in the years following landmark civil rights bills like the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. And you flash forward to 2014 when a white police officer in Ferguson, Missouri, shoots an unarmed African-American 18-year-old. And the protests that erupted after that were incredibly powerful. And this all happened when we had a black president, which probably was an important part of the context of those protests in places like Ferguson and in New York after the death of Eric Garner, because there was a sense that things were supposed to be different and they weren't different. Many Latinx people were frustrated as well because Obama became known as the deporter-in-chief as undocumented immigrants were deported in record numbers.
Right. Obama ends up taking Bill Clinton's enforcement policy on steroids. Again, kind of having to say, I'm not going to take the label of being weak on these issues of, let's say, crime or immigration. And again, that legacy leads to where we are now.
But Noel, it wasn't all bad news.
I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
You probably remember that when Obama first got elected, he supported civil unions, but not same-sex marriage. And in his second term, his position had, quote, evolved. And the Supreme Court goes on to uphold same-sex marriage. In fact, the Pew Research Center found that among Gen Zers, which is the generation that comes after millennials, about a third of them say they know someone who uses a gender-neutral pronoun to identify themselves.
Right. Really, the last 40 years in terms of the LGBTQ community has been like an explosion from, again, total kind of invisibility to now, you know, legalization of gay marriage. And immigrants are actually taking cues from the LGBTQ struggle and saying, we're coming out of the closet, we're saying we're undocumented and we're unafraid. That has happened over the last 40 years. It really is extraordinary.
And Noel, what's striking to me is just how many of these conversations that Americans were having in 1979, we are still having today. I mean, we still have not figured out how we make schools equitable, right, across races. We're still deciding basic questions like who gets to be American.
Yeah.
Right? And so in 40 years, we're going to be grappling with what that looks like in a country in which most of the people, most of the Gen Zers, are not white. We could very much have a country that is majority brown with most of the country's wealth living with white people. We could still be wrestling with the same inequality, even if numerically it looks a lot different. So I hope in 40 years, we've at least made progress in resolving some of these questions that have bedeviled us, like, since the beginning of the Republic.
Do Gene Demby is the co-host of NPR's Code Switch podcast, and Maria Hinojosa is host of the Latino USA podcast. Thank you guys both so much. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Noel.
Appreciate you.
North Carolina.
Raleigh's Oberlin Village has a proud history that goes back to its founding by former enslaved people around 1870. It's one of the first freedmen communities in the city. And for decades, it was home to carpenters, brick masons, and seamstresses. It was the launching point for several important African-American leaders like James E. Shepard and Willis Graves. Oberlin Village was indeed a thriving African-American community in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but development and urban renewal have mostly erased it from the landscape. Efforts are underway to restore some of what's been lost and preserve the memory of the neighborhood. Writer Howard Kraft has recently created a play about Willis Graves Jr., a civil rights attorney who grew up in Oberlin Village. It's called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. and the Pursuit of Justice. Play is going to be read Thursday afternoon as part of a two-day symposium on historic preservation, Oberlin Village, and social justice. It's hosted by Preservation North Carolina, and playwright Howard Kraft joins me now to talk about the play and the legacy of Oberlin Village. Welcome back, Howard.
Good to be here, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about this, because you've researched this community now for your work. Tell us about Oberlin Village and what it was like at its founding.
Well, Oberlin Village, first let me say I was introduced to all of this this project by Thomas Sayre, one of our great visual artists. He was constructing a memorial. He had been hired to construct a memorial by Smead York for the Oberlin community. Mm-hmm. And that gave me an opportunity to not only do my own research, but to actually talk to people who lived there, who knew the history as well as had lived some of the history. And the result of that was some poetry that was placed on the monument. It is a exciting story. Oberlin was founded by James H. Harris, and he's one of the founders. And it was called Oberlin because he went to Oberlin. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Oberlin was known for its abolitionists. So when he came back and they founded that village, town, part of Raleigh, they chose the name Oberlin. And it was purchased by freedmen and former slaves, $50 an acre. They bought from people who had once owned them, and created a village that was made up of artisans, carpenters, masons that would go out and basically build Raleigh. Mm. A lot of buildings you see downtown Cameron Village, a lot of those doers and workers came from the Oberlin community, and also is a community where they valued education with schools for the children and for adults too. And the people that came from there, like James E. Shepard, John Baker, the list goes on.
Well, and Willis Graves Jr.
is the subject
of your play. So tell us about Willis Graves Jr.
Willis Graves Jr. comes from, of course, that strong legacy of great leaders from Oberlin. His father was actually Justice of the Peace. And so he grew up, and his father was also the chair of the Emancipation Day convention, where they would come back and have Emancipation Day speakers. And his father would also run for the House of Representatives. So he grew up around forward-thinking, progressive black people who were trying to, carve a world out of, being surrounded by the height of oppression. This is the height of lynching. This is the height of the Ku Klux Klan. And so that formation in that environment would drive him later, after Shaw, to attend Howard Law School and to become a part of the cases that really changed the way housing works in the whole country.
Yeah, it's fascinating to think about this enclave, which does give strength and courage to the people who are living there, as you say, surrounded by a fairly hostile environment, one so hostile that Willis Graves Jr. really feels like he has to leave. He has to go to Detroit.
Yeah, I think, one of the things I say from in the piece is that every African-American who could and had the means to was trying to get out. Because what we have at the end of slavery is, slavery 2.0, but now we call it Jim Crow. And
sharecropping.
Yeah, sharecropping, which is basically the same thing, except for now it works out better for the for those who own the property, because now I no longer have to feed you. I no longer have to clothe you. That's all on you, and I can lock you to this land, and if you try to leave, you know. And we see the results around the same time. You have the massacre in Elaine, Arkansas, which is basically about black sharecroppers trying to unionize to keep from getting cheated, 237 African-Americans murdered. So this is right at the heart of a very violent time to be black in this country. You know,
he goes to Detroit. He becomes an attorney, and interestingly enough, he defends a landmark case in many ways in the early 20s in Detroit. Talk about that.
Yeah,
case.
We talk about that a lot in the play. Ossian Sweet case. So Ossian Sweet was a doctor from. He was from Florida, but he was at Howard's Medical School at the same time that Mr. Graves was in law school, and they became fast friends. He would even introduce Graves to his wife. And then they thought that Detroit was a place, because so many African Americans were moving to Detroit because of the automobile industry and the factory work, that, you know, these folks are going to need lawyers. These folks are going to need doctors. Right. And this is the North. You know, this is Zion. But then when they get there, they find out that there are officially 35,000 official members of the Ku Klux Klan in Detroit, and that the political system is totally infiltrated by white supremacists.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama. Hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record.
Right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay.
Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
And this is the North, you know. This is Zion. But then when they get there, they find out that there are officially 35,000 official members of the Ku Klux Klan in Detroit, and that the political system is totally infiltrated by white supremacists. And it's in this environment that his friend Ossian Sweet buys a house in this white neighborhood, and the house is surrounded by hundreds of angry white people. They start throwing things through the window, things against the house, and it's just a very few cops there. So basically, when the mob decides to take them, they're going to get taken. But Ossian Sweet had some friends and one of his family members, and when the stuff started to hit the house, they started firing over the crowd. Well, one of those bullets went into the crowd and killed a man, and another man was wounded. And so everybody in the house was put on trial for murder. And so Graves was an assistant in that case and a very close friend of Ossian Sweet. So in the play, you know, this is a pivotal case for him in terms of what he will do afterwards and continue to do and the outcome of that case. And so focus a lot on that.
He wins an acquittal. In Detroit in the 1920s. So this is an incredible. I tell you what, I'm talking to Howard Kraft now, who's written a play called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. in the Pursuit of Justice. The play is going to be read this afternoon at Shaw University. It's part of a 2-day symposium hosted by Preservation North Carolina. We talk about that because this attorney actually grew up in Oberlin Village, and we're talking about the rich history of that. I wonder if you could set this up and maybe read just a little piece from your play.
Sure. The play is set up in 1957. Ossian Sweet wins a scroll, an award from the NAACP at their convention. This will be the same convention that Dr. King would get the Sprengon Medal. So the play is set up as what I imagine his speech might be. And this is just part of what I think he may have said in that 1957 NAACP convention speech. And so the play is centered around that, but then we flash back to different moments in his life through his speech. And so I'm going to read the part of Graves Jr. and also a little part of Mary. So hopefully we can do, you know, people will be able to tell the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is Graves Jr. There was a saying I heard growing up. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. It goes, there's nothing a white man with a nickel hates more in this world than a Negro with a dime. So the question becomes for the Negro, do I cease to seek progress in this country? Do I cease to seek liberty in the pursuit of happiness because my happiness, my stability, my American dream is offensive to racists? No, No and no again. Too many have died. Too many have sacrificed. Too much injustice has been done. But I have been told that this America, this nation, is a nation of laws. So I decided that my role in the struggle for quality, for equality, for our people was to become a lawyer and do everything in my power to make sure those laws were working for us, to use those laws to protect us and aid us in our forward progression on this long, long road to fair treatment and human rights. Walking that road has led me to my involvement in some very important cases over the years. I have worked with and learned from some of the greatest legal minds in this country, from Thurgood Marshall to Clarence Darrow. In 1945, I embarked upon a case that would be attached to the Shelley versus Kramer case, which would make its way all the way to the Supreme Court. The McGee case, like the Shelley case, came down to this, as one of McGee's relatives put it. Action moves to Mary McGee. We work every day. We pay taxes. We send our men to war when the country calls on us. We love our children and want what's best for them. We save our money. Why can't we buy houses we can pay for? Why can't we live where we want to live? Either we're Americans or we aren't. We are. We are Americans. We have been in the country longer than many European descendants, some of whom are the very people who were threatened and tried to kill us to keep us out of certain neighborhoods and housing. We are Americans. Our mothers and fathers built this land through blood, sweat, and tears under the pain of the lash and fed this nation, clothed this nation, built the very building our president resides in. And so, yes, we will live where we choose, like any other American.
Howard Kraft reading some of his work called Bending the Arc, Willis Graves Jr. in the Pursuit of Justice. Play is going to be read this afternoon at Shaw University in Raleigh as part of a two-day symposium hosted by Preservation North Carolina.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that these are the breaks.
When Virginia Democrats swept control of the state house this week, one factor some voters cited was gun control. In May, a mass shooting in Virginia Beach killed 12 people. Afterwards, Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat, convened a special session of the state legislature.
He had hoped to pass gun control measures, what he called common sense legislation. But Republicans were in control. They shelved the bills and ended the special session after just 90 minutes. Fast forward to this week.
I have one question for you. Do you all like the color blue? I said, do you like the color blue? Because I'm here to officially declare today, November the 5th, 2019, that Virginia is officially blue. Congratulations.
Democrats will take control of the legislature in January.
Governor Northam joins me now from the governor's office in Richmond. Governor Northam, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You and I last spoke shortly after that awful day in Virginia Beach and the shooting. You introduced 8 measures then. We don't have time to tick through all of them, but they have to do with background checks, with red flag laws, with bans. Will you be pushing for that same agenda this time or even more?
Absolutely. I will start with those 8 pieces of what I call common sense gun legislation. They have been proven to save lives, and that's what we want to do in Virginia. So we will start with those pieces of legislation. I'm sure there will be others that will be introduced. I think they will be well vetted in both the House and the Senate. And, you know, depending on what gets to my desk, I'll certainly consider those. And if we feel that they'll make Virginia safer, we'll move forward with them as well.
Is your sense that any Republican minds have been changed on this issue? Do you have any hope of buy-in from Republican lawmakers?
It's an interesting question. And, you know, we were inundated with commercials and mailers during the campaign. And so some of the Republicans ran on common sense gun legislation. So I look forward to seeing their response. I think that they listen to voters. I know they do. And seeing how this election went on Tuesday, I hope that they'll be at the table. They should be. This shouldn't be a partisan issue.
May I ask about one specific change you advocated before, and it sounds like it's on your list, an assault weapons ban.
Yes.
What is your plan for assault weapons currently owned by Virginians that are already out there? Will you confiscate them?
No, ma'am, not at this stage. What we're looking at the banning the sales of assault weapons. We'll certainly, you know, again, vet these pieces of legislation. But that would be what we would start with.
You would propose a ban on sales going forward?
Absolutely.
Okay. In terms of pushback that you received last time, I'm curious about one other thing and whether it has changed. There's been a lot of reporting on the NRA.
Yes.
And their leadership challenges and funding challenges. Is your sense that there is as much energy in the pro-gun rights lobby in your state as there was, I don't know, back in May or a year ago?
You know, that certainly the advocacy is still out there. But, you know, I think that, the you know, for Virginians to experience what happened in our backyard on Memorial Day weekend, you know, I think the influence of the NRA, especially in Virginia, has weakened. Yes, ma'am, and I think we'll continue to see that.
But their pockets are deep, and so is their influence, particularly in a southern state like Virginia. Are you confident that you can overcome the power of that lobby and actually get eight pieces of legislation through the state house?
I am, because the Virginian spoke on Tuesday, and that's the most powerful thing out there is their vote, and they did that despite the money that the NRA poured into Virginia.
And can you get this done if you don't get any Republican buy-in? Are the votes there?
Yes, ma'am, they are. I don't know of any Democrats that would be opposed to these eight pieces of common sense legislation that we have proposed in the past and we will do again in January.
Last thing, as you speak to voters in Virginia, what do they tell you? What is your sense of to what extent the gun issue was mobilizing people at the polls this week?
It was a large factor. And, you know, I saw that. The tragedy that we had in Virginia and then the Republicans' response when I brought them back to Richmond to just spend less than 90 minutes talking about common sense gun legislation, that was a large factor. And people have said enough is enough. And, you know, we've been talking about these things, but now we have the opportunity to take action, and that's what we intend to do in January.
May I point out, you still sound kind of bitter about that less than 90 minutes in January. Are you hand over heart determined to reach across the aisle and try to get Republicans on board this time around?
I will, and I think probably folks know of my history. I served in the United States Army. I took care of wounded soldiers. I'm also a pediatrician, so I've seen what happens when toddlers pick up loaded firearms on the, you know, on the bedside table. So I have heard enough well-intended people say that our thoughts and prayers are with these families. But now it's time for legislators, for our leaders to come to Richmond and take votes and pass laws. And that's what I expect will happen in January.
Governor, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always good talking to you.
And you. That's Ralph Northam. He is the governor of Virginia.
What are you talking about?
That's right. We're moving to Mississippi. And you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter, I.
Most states have moved in recent years to automatically restore voting rights to people who complete their prison sentences. Where that doesn't happen, civil rights groups are suing on behalf of ex-felons. One of those cases is in Mississippi. It's challenging a lifetime ban there on voting for people convicted of certain crimes, citing a discriminatory system put in place during the Jim Crow era. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
A heated race for governor is underway in Mississippi, but Dennis Hopkins won't be voting this week.
I've never voted in my life because by the time I got in trouble, I was not able, at the age to vote.
Under Mississippi law, Hopkins is barred from voting because of a grand larceny conviction when he was a young man. He completed his sentence 16 years ago.
It's horrible. It makes you feel like less of a man, less of a citizen. It makes you feel that your voice is not heard, your thoughts are not heard.
Hopkins, now 43, works for the city of Potts Camp, Mississippi. He's a Little League coach, volunteer firefighter, and foster parent. And he's a lead plaintiff in one of two class action lawsuits challenging Mississippi's permanent ban on voting for people convicted of certain felonies. Attorney Paloma Wu with the Southern Poverty Law Center is representing the former felons and argues Mississippi's law is unconstitutional.
automatic lifetime stripping of the right to vote, even after you have completed your sentence, repaid your debt to society, is cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment.
Wu says Mississippi's law is unique because the only way to get back the right to vote is to enlist the help of the governor or have a special suffrage bill passed in your name through the state legislature with a two-thirds majority. Wu says politicians have unfettered discretion.
What's amazing about particularly the suffrage bill process is you're asking people who are elected officials to decide who gets to vote and who doesn't.
Wu says it's an arbitrary and racially discriminatory process rooted in the state's 1890 Constitution, adopted with the stated intent to, quote, secure to the state of Mississippi white supremacy, according to the Journal of the Proceedings. Attorney Rob McDuff with the Mississippi Center for Justice calls it a great tragedy of Mississippi history.
The white leadership of the state gathered to write a new constitution with the avowed purpose of taking the vote away from African Americans who had attained it in the wake of the Civil War, the abolition of slavery, and the passage of the 15th Amendment.
Newly freed black people were the majority and considered a threat to the white power structure. McDuff says the document named a set of felonies for disenfranchisement, crimes the framers believed to be primarily committed by African Americans and poor white people.
It's a bizarre collection that includes bribery, theft, arson, false pretenses, perjury, forgery, embezzlement, and bigamy.
In the 1960s, the state added serious offenses like rape and murder. Still, Attorney Wu argues it remains a vestige of Jim Crow that should go by the way of the poll tax.
We've been sort of lawsuit by lawsuit, movement by movement in the last 100 years trying to make our way back to where African Americans in Mississippi can have participation in the political process.
Republican Secretary of State Delbert Hoseman and Democratic Attorney General Jim Hood declined to comment on the ongoing litigation. Both officials are running for higher office in Tuesday's election. The Mississippi lawsuits are part of a broader national movement to rethink felon voting bans.
I think we are finally reconciling those historical misdeeds with our contemporary realities.
Political scientist Kalila Brown Dean of Quinnipiac University in Connecticut tracks state policy on felon voting rights. She says the landscape has shifted in the last 20 years as more states pass reenfranchisement laws or citizens push to automatically restore the vote to ex-felons, such as last year's referendum in Florida. Increasingly, she says, it has become a legal question. The ACLU recently sued Minnesota over denying voting rights to people on probation. A federal appeals court in December will consider whether the lawsuits in Mississippi will proceed. Brown Dean says there's a high bar.
We use the language of a right to vote, but there is no affirmative constitutional right to vote in this country. Because states set the time, the place, and the manner of elections, they then determine who is eligible to vote.
For Dennis Hopkins in Potts Camp, Mississippi, it's about getting a fair shot at fully participating in civic life.
Doesn't everybody deserve a second chance?
Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Jackson, Mississippi.
But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
And finally today, a film about one man's journey into and out of a white supremacist gang. But what's truly remarkable is that the man at the center of the story is black, and it's based on true events. The film is called Farming. It refers to the practice in 1960s England when Nigerian parents paid white working-class British families to foster their kids. The hope was that the children would have better opportunities in Europe. Adewale Akinoye Agbaje, the writer and director, was one of these children. The film follows a young, withdrawn Enitan as he grows up in a crowded foster home. Facing neglect and emotional abuse there, he joins a skinhead gang led by white supremacists. The story is based on Agbaje's life, so you already know the ending. He left a life of violence and became a lawyer and a celebrated actor with starring roles in TV shows like Lost and Oz. This is Agbaje's directorial debut, so I asked him why he wanted to tell his own story.
It was important for me to share an experience of a black child growing up in Britain. Many, certainly across the pond in America, have a certain perception of Britain, whether it's the monarchy, the Beatles, James Bond, and things like that. But nobody is really aware of the 8 million or so black immigrant populations that's resident and lives there, and also how they came about to be there. And it's a phenomenon that was unknown, and it's a voice for a forgotten generation of foster Nigerian children like myself.
You know, it explores a spectrum of racist sentiments, from the subtle to the violently hostile. You know, your foster family, the mother in the film Ingrid, is played by Kate Beckinsale, who always reminds her kids that they would be in a much – they could be in a much worse place. And she's referring to their parent – to the children's homeland, Nigeria, and she calls it Wooga Wooga Land. You know, I think a lot of people from minority communities would recognize this kind of racism. Can you explain what you wanted to highlight with Kate Beckinsale's character?
Well, Kate Beckinsale's character, she plays the character of Ingrid, who was my foster mother, is to a large degree a product of her environment. And what I wanted to show is the complexities of racism and ignorance, because the very vernacular of the day, the wallpaper of the day, was very racist and it was acceptable in society. And so that was obviously projected onto us as children. So even though there may not have been an ill intent to harm, right, the impact on the recipient, i.e. us as the children, was devastating. And in the sense that when you're constantly surrounded with these kind of racial slurs and epithets and names without anybody to empower you or tell you you're black and you're beautiful, right, you begin to identify with those.
You know, and the main character, Anitan, who's based on you as a young boy, a young teenager, really internalizes that casual racism he hears at home. He loves his foster mom. And then you have this scene where he goes back to Nigeria with his birth parents and feels very alienated and doesn't understand this culture of his parents, doesn't feel that he belongs there. He gets sent back to England. What draws him to this skinhead gang? Why does he seek acceptance among a group of people who hate him?
Well, the environment in the home was a breeding ground for self-hatred, you know. And then when you're taken to Nigeria suddenly, after having been exposed only to that white kind of culture, albeit hostile, that is the home that you know. Mm-hmm. So the culture shock there was traumatic. And then to return back, there was an obvious difficulty in reconciling the realities in a 9-year-old boy's mind, like where he belonged. He was considered a foreigner in Africa. He was considered a foreigner in Britain. He didn't fit anywhere. And yet he wanted to cling to the reality that he knew, which is the hostile racist reality in England. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, scrubbing off his skin, trying to fit in, trying to belong, trying to be accepted was what a 9-year-old boy wanted to be. And I recall as that 9-year-old boy being constantly set upon by these gangs of whether skinheads or local yobs and coming home crying all the time. And my foster father, he basically put me outside the house and said, "This is how it's going to be for you. Either you go out there and fight them or I will beat you." And what that meant is a part of me died that day, the child in me. And I had to defend myself against 2 and 3 of these bullies and thugs that were racially attacking me. And eventually that began to give me a reputation for the young boy that was able to take a beating and give one back.
Right.
And so that brought the attention of the skinheads as a form of amusement. Here was this young kid that was sprightly and would keep fighting back. Mm-hmm. And eventually I became a useful ally in fighting other rival gangs. I was never considered one of them in the sense that I was never accepted. I was always made aware of who and what I was. So there was this very uneasy and volatile alliance with this racist skinhead group.
You know, in this moment, this film is particularly resonant because the U.S. and many European countries are dealing with a resurgence of white nationalism and racial violence. And given your experience with this type of hatred, both self-hatred and hatred on these communities, what advice do you have for people who find themselves under attack and for those who are caught up in the midst of attacking?
Oh, I mean,
it's a big question.
Well, it is. I mean, the thing is, for those that are on the ground and being attacked, you know, it just has to be made clear the type of persecution that's going on, because it's life and death for those people that are in it. And those that are in the gangs, I mean, what can I say? I mean, there's no justification for the infliction of abuse or harm on another person because of gender, race, or any other difference. But in many cases, these people are very much products of their own environment and victims of it to a degree. And what, in fact, the irony was, there was more in common with the skinheads than there was differences. You know, we were outsiders. We were from dysfunctional families. And in fact, that became a glue. And I think what those people have to do, again, it's about demystifying the rhetoric and understand what's really going on.
That was Adewale Akinoye Agbaje. He is the writer and director of the new film, Farming. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy. But peace. Amen.
Looted artwork, destroyed artifacts, and damaged historical sites are often overlooked casualties in war zones. Now, the U.S. military has taken concrete steps to protect those antiquities by creating the Cultural Heritage Task Force. It's a partnership with the Smithsonian Institution. The idea is to find Army Reserve officers who also happen to be museum curators, archaeologists, and other specialists in conservation, and assign them to the unit. Task Force members would then deploy with and advise troops during fighting on how to protect local sites. Colonel Scott DeJesse helped develop the new program, and he joins us from his office in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to tell us more. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
So most listeners are probably familiar with the success that a similar unit had protecting historical sites and returning stolen artwork during World War II. So how will today's Cultural Heritage Task Force be the same or different from the Monuments Men?
What we're going to do is provide a new capability, basically civilian expertise that cannot be generated in the Department of Defense. And the difference between the Monuments Men of World War II and the Cultural Heritage Preservation Officers of today is the way the conflicts have recently been fought. So World War II was about capturing cities and defeating armies. Recent conflicts have been more about the populace. So cultural heritage, it's kind of tying more into how it relates to people.
Right. So it happens that the U.S. has been in conflict for some two decades now, first in Afghanistan, then Iraq, troops in Syria.
Yep.
And these are places with centuries of history, Iraq and Syria referred to as the cradle of civilization. So how much did those settings have to do with the desire to form this new unit?
Yeah, it played an involvement because there was a lack of capability there. And a lot of times the government would turn to the Smithsonian or, you know, there's elements of the State Department that deal with this. But when it's combat, those type of institutions and organizations can't enter in that space. There's got to be uniformed personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years of conflict, this capability has been missed.
Right. So what are some examples of historic sites, artifacts, works of art that have been lost in conflict that you're thinking of when you think about this capability going forward?
You know, 2003, the looting in the Museum of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. Looting, since the history of warfare, this has taken place. It's a resource. It could be traded on the illicit market. The museum in Kabul lost a lot of its collections. The building was 50% of it was destroyed. wherever there's conflict, cultural property is being destroyed and being looted. Once the civil society starts breaking down and conflict becomes an issue, cultural property, it gets illegally transferred or it gets destroyed.
I just think about history as identity and part of the history of a nation, and that's a loss you can't get back, really.
Yeah, a keen interest of mine is intangible cultural heritage. The idea that this is directly connected to our hearts and our minds, and this is the beliefs that we carry with us, our social practices. And with people that are displaced in conflict, they kind of get separated and moved around, and you start losing a lot of that heritage that defines us. What we're saying is protect cultural heritage. It actually helps to get to peace and stability, and making that argument more relevant to military commanders.
These are zones that are dangerous, that would be difficult for civilians to go into. Will the members be soldiers first, conservators second? How would that work?
Well, first and foremost, we're soldiers. But our expertise in the area of cultural heritage supports the mission commander. We wear the uniform. We serve the mission of whatever is dictated and directed by the commander.
Now, you're an artist yourself. How did that inform your work in developing this team?
I went to art school to get a Bachelor of Fine Arts, and then I was doing ROTC separately. And to think that these worlds somehow have merged back on each other is incredible. What we want to do is work with the local countries and make them the monuments men and women of their own country. That's really what we're trying to get to.
That's Army Reserve Colonel Scott DeJesse, who helped develop the military's new Cultural Heritage Task Force. Thanks so much, and good luck.
Thank you.
My skin, my logo. Yeah.
Right, so if you go to a dermatologist with, say, a rash, chances are the doctor is going to want to take a look, right? So much of diagnosing skin conditions comes down to what the doctor sees. But as Dina Pritchett reports, some are raising concerns about whether doctors are getting the whole picture in their training.
Can you show Mama how to blow bubbles? No?
Like a lot of new parents, Ellen Buchanan Weiss is pretty into her kid.
We adopted him when he was 11 days old. He is gentle, sweet, hilarious, on the go all day.
And like a lot of new parents, Buchanan Weiss had all sorts of questions during that blurry first year. Like after her son's 12-month vaccinations, when he broke out in a rash.
I'm trying to figure out, would I be paranoid if I went to the doctor at this point? Is that a reasonable thing to do? So I started Googling it.
We're talking image searches, also looking at pages from the Mayo Clinic, CDC. But her son has brown skin.
And it became immediately clear to me that the vast majority of even common skin conditions are on white skin. You have to scroll down like 80 pictures to find a single one on brown skin.
It's not surprising, but it is concerning, very concerning.
Dr. Lynn McKinley Grant is a dermatology professor at Howard University and president of the Skin of Color Society. She knows there's a gap, and not just on the internet.
Often in medical schools, they have limited pictures of diseases in skin of people of color.
And that's a big problem. Medical school is a lot of pattern recognition, especially when it comes to dermatology. You see picture after picture to encode them into your brain. And if you don't see pictures of different skin types, you may not be able to diagnose them. Take rashes.
You'll hear a term called erythema.
Erythema, the official medical term from the Greek word for red. But rashes don't always look red on dark skin. They can look kind of purple or barely show up at all.
So I've had patients who have said they go in and they tell the doctor that they have redness. And the doctor can't see it. They're like, well, there's nothing there. You know, just put some lotion on and go home.
McKinley Grant says schools are making an effort to diversify training materials, but they've still got a ways to go. And this problem could get even worse. Dr. Roxana Donishju is a dermatology resident at Stanford. For her PhD, she's looking at artificial intelligence.
If we don't fix the biases that we have in healthcare before we jump to training a computer to do it, we're just going to actually perpetuate those biases.
The computer learns the same way students do. Donishju and her team feed in image after image to create a tool that can help doctors recognize patterns. And when there aren't images of darker skin, the algorithm, like a doctor, won't be as good at diagnosing people of color. whether that's an allergic reaction or a Lyme disease rash or skin cancer.
Addressing bias and improving diversity are not tangential issues. They are actually central to providing equitable health care.
So how do you get more diverse images? There are resources, especially for doctors and medical students. But people have to seek them out. And sometimes they don't even realize what's missing. For Ellen Buchanan Weiss, who couldn't find pictures that looked like her son, the answer was right on her phone.
I thought to myself, well, you know, I could just open an Instagram account.
Buchanan Weiss launched Brown Skin Matters in August, posting pictures of skin conditions on people of color. And in just a few months, she got over 7,000 followers.
I expected moms to want this resource, but I've been surprised at how much of the attention has been from medical professionals.
All of the dermatologists we spoke with stressed that this is not a substitute for a medical exam, but it is a resource, and it's helping raise awareness of the problem, which is one of the first steps to making sure that the picture of the future looks a little different. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, and she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
Could gene editing be used to treat cancer? Well, researchers say they could be a step closer to realizing that goal. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has the details.
The new approach combines two of the hottest discoveries in biomedical science, the powerful gene editing technique called CRISPR and immunotherapy, using patients' own immune system cells to fight their cancer.
The last decade has been really a revolution in the immunotherapy for cancer.
Edward Statmauer is at the University of Pennsylvania.
We've really learned how to harness the immune system to treat cancer, to create these miraculous cells that are infused into patients as living drugs to treat cancer.
But those genetically engineered living drugs don't work for lots of cancer patients or only work for a little while. That's where CRISPR gene editing comes in.
We're using this CRISPR technology to make these cells work even better and potentially attack the cancer better.
Here's how it works. Doctors take key immune system cells out of patients' bodies. Next, scientists use CRISPR to edit genes in the cells. Then, doctors infuse the modified cells back into patients' bodies.
We want to see if we can allow the cells to have sort of superpowers to either proliferate even better, to stay in the patients better as living drugs, and to potentially attack even more directly the tumor.
Statmauer's team infused about 100 million of these edited cells into three patients, two fighting multiple myeloma and one with sarcoma. And so far, it looks like the cells survive, function, and are safe.
We demonstrated safety. We demonstrated feasibility. And that's really the most important finding of this study, given that this is the first of its kind in patients with cancer.
Now, Statmauer cautions that it's far too soon to know whether the approach will actually help patients live longer. This study was designed only to see if it's feasible and safe, but he's optimistic.
This treatment is not ready for prime time, but in many ways, this is the beginning of the next generation of engineering of cells to help many different diseases and many different tumors.
Other researchers agree.
I'm just so excited about this.
Jennifer Doudna helped develop CRISPR at the University of California, Berkeley.
It's an important step on the path towards using CRISPR genome editing in patients and shows the potential of this technology to be a safe and effective therapy.
But others are more cautious. Michelle Sadelin at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center is doing similar research.
I don't think there's much to conclude yet. Probably want more patients and a longer follow-up to really make a call that the use of CRISPR is safe, but the data are certainly encouraging.
Several studies are already underway or starting soon, testing CRISPR for genetic blood disorders, an inherited form of blindness, and other forms of cancer. And Stadtmauer's group plans to treat more cancer patients soon. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
As we reported last night, genetic genealogy, the technique millions of people use to learn about their family history, has now become a potent tool for police to crack previously unsolved crimes. Tonight, William Brangham is back to explore the growing privacy debate around this new technique and why some people are urging that we slow down. This is part of our regular series on the leading edge of science and technology.
That was me, Uncle David, Uncle Derek.
After her dad died, Brandy Jennings, like millions of Americans, used one of those DNA testing kits to learn more about him and other relatives.
I didn't have a close relationship with my dad, so, you know, maybe find some family members and just kind of learn about his side, you know.
But when she got her results, she tried something new. She uploaded them to a free public DNA database to find out more about her dad's side of the family.
I uploaded it, and then it takes a few days for it to upload and analyze, and I just kind of forgot about it.
But months later, Jennings was shocked to learn that police had used her DNA information from that public website and used a technique called genetic genealogy to identify the killer in a 40-year-old cold case in Iowa.
Authorities arrested 64-year-old Jerry Lynn Burns of Manchester this morning.
Turns out the murderer was a distant relative of Jennings. She thinks this new crime-fighting tool is a great thing.
I mean, I think that every person that's ever died or been killed or raped or whatever deserves to have justice done.
But not everyone is so eager to have their DNA end up in a police dragnet. 5 years ago, Michael Usry Jr., largely because his father had done DNA testing, ended up in a police station in downtown New Orleans. Police suspected he'd been involved in the brutal 1996 rape and murder of an Idaho woman named Angie Dodge.
In fact, almost the entire time they had me in the interrogation room with the one-way mirror and all, they really didn't want to give me any information. I kept asking questions like, you know, did somebody I know do something horrible? And finally, after maybe about an hour or two, they had to just basically go, no, we think that you were involved with this crime. And I'm like, me?
Usry was targeted because investigators, using an early form of genetic genealogy, linked his father's DNA to DNA from the murder scene. Usry's dad seemed too old to be the killer, but Michael was not. And then police learned Usry had traveled through Idaho. Plus, he made these grisly, violent, low-budget films.
Hands!
But Usry knew he hadn't done anything wrong.
It was almost like a dream. When it came crashing down was when they walked out of the room and the biggest state policeman that I've ever seen in my life came in with latex gloves and a cotton swab and said, I'm going to take your DNA now.
It took around a month for police to process Usry's DNA to see if it matched the DNA from the crime scene.
So you spend 3 or 4 weeks thinking, I'm a suspect in a brutal murder. What were those weeks like for you?
It was scary. It was really scary, those 3 or 4 weeks, just because I knew that I had not been involved in any crime.
When the DNA test results came back, it wasn't a match. Michael Usry Jr. was cleared. New York University's Aaron Murphy, who studies genetics and the law, sees Usry's ordeal as a cautionary tale. She says, remember, Michael Usry never tested his own DNA. He was ensnared because his father had. And Murphy says those decisions made by others cannot be undone.
You can change your phone number if someone starts harassing you. You can change your address if things get really dark. You know, you can do a lot of credit card cancellations if things get into the wrong hands, but you can't cancel your genome. You can't edit your genome. And more importantly, the decisions that you make about your genomic privacy, you know, can be overridden by anybody, not only in your immediate family tree. It's not just, oh, my brother chooses to do this, but my sixth cousin I never met chose to do this. That decision essentially erases the genetic privacy of everyone else.
But this gives you your percentage.
Curtis Rogers created the biggest public DNA database called GEDmatch that's now used by police to solve crimes. Rogers initially built it so people like Brandy Jennings could use their DNA results to build out their family tree. But after authorities in California used GEDmatch to catch the Golden State Killer, Rogers began to slowly welcome police into the database. And recently, a Florida judge granted a warrant on one case to let police in even more.
For some reason, people really get upset about serial killers, and mass killers, and serial rapists being caught. I don't know why this upsets people.
But they're not upset about people getting caught. They're upset about somehow that they're going to be roped into an investigation they would feel unfairly, or that their privacy would somehow be violated. Right?
If they could see some of the emails from these families that have had some closure, I can't imagine that anyone would say it's the wrong thing to do. I can't imagine anyone saying, I don't want to help these families.
Of course, I want those people, serial killers and murderers and, you know, terrible rapists, to be caught. But it's becoming such a powerful crime-fighting tool. It's also kind of, it scares me personally, because we see that it's being used for other purposes besides finding your uncle. In my case, it's used by the police to, you know, try to link me to a crime.
Years after Michael Usry Jr. was cleared, further genetic genealogy helped authorities identify the man they believe is Angie Dodge's real killer. A man named Brian Dripps, who was her neighbor, was charged with rape and murder and will go on trial in 2021. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm William Brangham.
Mm. Woo! Context of white supremacy. They said being used for other purposes besides finding your uncle. That happens so frequently in the system of white supremacy. Things are used for other purposes besides what has been explicitly stated. Frequently incorrect purposes. Racist purposes. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast. This is our compensatory call-in, Saturday, November 9, 2019. So I have been told. So much to get to. The number, if you have questions, suggestions, counter-racist thoughts, concepts, the number is 605-313-5164, be code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Dorothy Roberts, when she was on the program the third time, we talked quite a bit about this, and she had a lot of suspicions. I had suspicions when she was here at that time. I have even more now. I have never been a fan of any of those, because they have some of those sites that connect genetic material. It's specifically targeting black people, and it's, oh, we'll find your tribe from the continent and all this other nonsense. If people are fans of that, you know, you can be offended, but I have never been an advocate of any of that, because things are frequently used for other purposes than what has been explicitly stated. Lots to get to. Trying to go in order. I don't even have a reasonable order. Just try and see how much of it we can get done with the time that we have. Number one, Charles Blow. Dr. Welsing used to reference Mr. Blow. She read the news. She talk about reading the newspaper all the time, talk about trying to catch up to Dick Gregory and his rate of checking for information. But she would talk about Mr. Blow's columns because he often writes about racism, white supremacy. Mr. Blow is a black male victim of racism who has written a book talking about being sexually abused. I believe he identifies as bisexual. I might be remembering that incorrectly, but I think he has publicly identified in that way and talked about that in his book. He's talked about it and done interviews on Bill Maher and lots of other outlets. Anyway, he wrote a piece this week titled "Stop Blaming Black Homophobia for Buttigieg's Problems" with an exclamation point. This was from November 6th. And it reads, reducing Pete Buttigieg's struggle to attract black support solely to black homophobia is not only erroneous, it is a disgusting racist trope secretly nursed and insidiously whispered by white liberals with contempt for the very black people they court and need. I have never been blind to this. The people who see black religiosity as an indicator of primitive thinking and lack of enlightenment. For the record, I am... Thank you. For the record, I am bisexual and not a religious man. They are those who see black people as a blight on our big cities, pathologically prone to violence and in need of pity and crumbs they cast about and call philanthropy. They see these black voters as needing to be led, directed, and better informed rather than as sophisticated voters for fully capable of making informed decisions that they believe are best for their lives and communities. These people blame black voters when their candidate or their cause fails, even though black voters are the most consistently loyal Democrats in the country. It is tiresome and disappointing to constantly have to defend yourself not only from people who are openly hostile to you, but also from those who feign friendship but are secretly hostile to you. It is in the tribal nature of gay culture that white men still center their white maleness as privileged. Aren't there white women classified as gay, or do they exclusively go by lesbian? I think, wouldn't gay culture include white women too? Maybe I'm wrong. Feel free to correct Gus T. Just making sure that, getting back to the reading. White maleness is privileged if one step removed from that enjoyed by their heterosexual brothers, where racial minorities are too often fetishized and thingified, seen more as an opportunity than an equal. The latest round of blaming black homophobia for Buttigieg's lackluster black support came last month when McClatchy obtained the report from a focus group the Buttigieg campaign had conducted with black voters. According to McClatchy, the report found that being gay was a barrier for these voters, particularly for the men. Oh, my God, the disgusting black male. For the men who seemed deeply uncomfortable even discussing it. Oh, they're primitive. Their preference is for his sexuality to not be front and center. All that's in quotes. First thing to note here is the size of the group, only 24 people. The second thing is that focus groups aren't scientific surveys. As Liza Featherstone, author of Divining Desire, Focus Groups and the Culture of Consultation, has put it, focus groups are not a scientific and quantitative method of gathering knowledge. But none of that mattered. This fed a narrative that liberals, including some older black politicians and pundits, have nursed. Now, that's interesting because he didn't say white liberals. He just said liberals, but then he specifically called out black people. A raft of articles was published. Social media posts started to fly. South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn, black male, was asked about the focus group on CNN, and he fed into the narrative saying that it is a general issue. I know a lot of people my age who feel that way. The anchor asked if Clyburn was saying that for older African Americans, Buttigieg's gayness was an issue, and he responded, "Yes, it is. There's no question about that. I'm not going to sit here and tell you otherwise because I think everybody knows that's an issue." Really? Is there homophobia in the black community? Of course. Is it higher in the black community than in other communities? It is, but even that needs context. Acceptance and rejection of gayness is highly correlated to religiosity. Black people in general are more religious than other racial groups, but while black Protestants are more opposed to same-sex marriage than white mainline Protestants, more moderate, they are more supportive of it than white evangelical Protestants, more conservative, according to a May Pew Research Center report. Furthermore, it found that a majority of black people, 51%, now approve of gay marriage, just 7 percentage points fewer than Hispanics and 11 fewer than whites. That spread isn't inconsequential, but it also is not, but it's also not an overwhelming difference. But the most important question, it seems to me, is whether feelings about gayness dictate political actions. A 2007 study by researchers from the City University of New York found that though black Americans provide more harsh lip service attitude to homosexuality when it comes to discrimination behavior, they are much more supportive. Black people have a long history with discrimination in this country that can make it distasteful for them to abide in any form. In addition, whatever level of homophobia may exist in the black community, there's that word again, African Americans consistently vote for Democratic candidates with progressive views on gay rights. These Democratic presidential candidates haven't won a majority of the white vote in modern history, but time and again they get a clear majority of the black vote. Buttigieg isn't the only candidate struggling to strengthen his support among black voters. He will have to appeal to that group like he appeals to any other by listening and being responsive, and he's already doing that. A June Post and Courier Change research poll of likely Democratic primary voters found most notable is Buttigieg's growing support from black voters. He collected 6% African-American support, good enough for fourth this month after he received none in May. Black voters generally favor candidates with a demonstrated history of loyalty to the community. Wow, they made him use that word a lot. Buttigieg is a young man, relatively unknown, and with a curious history on race relations in South Bend, Indiana. That's an odd way of stating things. He will have to get over those hurdles. Pretending those hurdles don't exist, metaphors, and instead assigning the blame to black homophobia hurts Buttigieg's campaign more than it helps. And the people who are so committed to the black homophobia narrative must search themselves for the answer to this question: why do you need this trope to stay alive? That is Mr. Charles Blow, New York Times opinion writer from this week. I do not encourage the use of the word community, VGQ. We cannot have a community if we are subject to the system of white supremacy racism. But I just find it embarrassing if you are doing so bad and things are so poorly that you have to blame niggers being homophobes for your problems. That just shows me how pitiful you are. It's a system of white supremacy. You at least should be able to pay a focus group to come up with a better excuse than "we got nothing else. Just niggers are homophobic. That's all we got." Okay. Woo! Seems like we have used that one about 50 times this month, but all right. Niggers are homophobic. That's why we're losing. And 4 more years. That's the same thing that I've been saying since 2016. 4 more years. Don't have anything else to say on that. If anybody thinks that there's any way someone other than Mr. Trump will be president come 2021, would like to hear that, that would be news to me. 4 more years. Wow, so much to get to. So in addition to the word community, race relations, I certainly discourage that. Have talked about that for years. Race relations, not an accurate word. All right, so I believe I spoke a few weeks back. There was an incident of domestic violence by my neighbors, victims of racism. These are non-white people. And I looked outside my window and saw them out, you know, brawling in the street. Terrible. So that was a few months back, this summer, towards the end of the summer. So I see them this week. Things are calm, no brawling. And we're chatting, and I was going to reference something that happened the same day of the domestic violence incident. And so I'm talking to them, and I literally paused. I stopped, and I was searching for the word to use. Now, I studied for the SAT in my day. Think I got a 310, greatly retarded. I know, you know, a few words to describe a brawl. I thought melee, kerfuffle, dust up. I wasn't sure. I thought of all of the unpleasantness. That was another one. I think when I got to the point of almost saying unpleasantness, I stopped and I said, boy, I know some fool that says call things by their proper name a whole lot. I retracted from unpleasantness and just went back. So do you remember the domestic violence thing from this summer and blah, blah, blah. And I kept going. I'm not laughing. Domestic violence is not funny. That's not what I'm laughing at all. What I'm laughing at is when in my mind, I retracted from, should I say unpleasantness, kerfuffle, melee, when I discarded all of those and went with, use the correct term, domestic violence, and said that collectively, everyone who was present winced, and you could say, like, what? That's what I was laughing at, the collective expression amongst the group that I was talking to. And they said, oh, my God, like, why do you have to say that? I mean, what? My gosh. I mean, and the thing that was so beautiful, at least to me, the thing that was beautiful was that in the collective repulse that everyone expressed, when the one individual said, you know, why do you keep saying that? Why are you using that term? Like, my goodness, I'm not even saying that it wasn't domestic violence. I'm just saying, why do you have to say that? And I just thought that sound. Now I can even give more detail to my laughter. I said, man, that is exactly what I would expect in a system of white supremacy. Like, I would expect a white person like, whoa. What do you mean Dylann Roof is a murderer? I mean, I know he shot a few of the colored folks in the church, but I mean, you just going to call him a murderer? I mean, what? That's what I expect in a system of white supremacy. That is why I advocate, and I mean ruthlessly, call things by their proper name. We talk about having discretion in workplace racism. Absolutely. I'm not going to be saying white supremacy racism, even though that's the most accurate term, if I am working. But generally speaking, what is going to help us solve this problem sooner than later? Call things by their proper name. The system of white supremacy greatly encourages a lot of pussyfooting, lying, with the primary weapon is deception. That's how you end up with diversity crises. What was one of the ones that we heard this week? If things really get dark, they had quite a few of them. The metaphors this week, race relations, that's how we end up with all of that. Call things by their proper name. And first time, last time, that is stated for a reason. First time, last time. Read that in Gavin DeBecker, Gift of Fear. Super important. But I was super proud to have bothered people by saying domestic violence, even though I did take a minute to think. I hesitated. Should I call it domestic violence? I can't think of a more accurate term. Bing. Anyway, next on the list, I did use early in the audio segment when they got to the incident of the Mormon family in the area known as Mexico being killed. Value of white life. I think these individuals are classified as white. and the amount of time, energy, resources going into this crime. And they even have reports talking about, wow, a whole lot of non-white people get killed in Mexico and they don't do anything about it. Like this case, they have got all of this resources and time. And they didn't say the value of white life, but that was my interpretation of it using my brain computer, Dr. Welsing metaphor. But I used this segment of Bob Avakian, suspected white supremacist, talking about Dennis Rodman, victim of racism, who 20 years ago, he said it was difficult to play in Utah because of all of the effing Mormons. I think he got fined and got in a whole lot of trouble. White people were not pleased with him at all, and they conveniently avoided, oh, wow, Mormons have a history of being kind of hostile and racist towards black people. Maybe that's what motivated the worm to make those comments, insightful though they may have been. They didn't include that, but that was why I picked that to start the segment about the attack in Mexico. Oh, my Lord. I'll save that for the metaphor. I'll come back to that for the metaphor. I knew I had written down quite a few of them. They mentioned Willis Graves Jr., Ozzie Sweet, when they were talking about the history of black people in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I thought that was important. That was just another illustration out of millions more to come. Whites, they come. They attack the black people, are throwing things at the residents, and the black people fought back. I think that is extraordinarily important because so frequently that gets erased. The narrative is black people are cowards. Black people don't fight back. All of the warriors, I think that was said more recently, all of the warriors are gone. We just have, you know, the people who didn't fight back or don't fight back or are too scared. Like that is a very, you talk about tropes. That is a super common trope. And I think a part of that is just because race soldiers have been so successful. That's what Paul Robeson talked about. They didn't want to do a play of Denmark Vesey. They didn't want to do a play of Toussaint L'Ouverture. They didn't want to do a play of that. They didn't want to do a play of Nat Turner. When Nate Parker finally got around, he just became another raping, toxic black male, too. We don't want to see that. We don't want to see any images of black people fighting back. They don't have a big biopic on Joan Little, who killed a white police officer who tried to rape her. They don't have that. They don't want to show black people fighting back and killing white people, counter violence. They just want the narrative to be, if there was any fighting, white people did it or the white people led it. And, you know, the cowardly niggers sang and prayed. That's the general narrative that they want. That's, we just talked about that yesterday with Paul Robeson. They didn't even want to show film. They wouldn't even let him make a movie of Joe Louis because they did not want to show a black male knocking out a white man. And they use that same logic for not wanting to show films of Jack Johnson when he was champion. That'd be a cowbell for that, too. But not wanting to show this information. In fact, even more recent examples, Cokie Thornton, when we just had Colin Douglas on the program, white man, University of Iowa, and he was talking about this black male who shot and killed white people in St. Louis, in Missouri, where they were messing over black people and practicing racism before Michael Brown Jr. I hadn't even heard about this case. This is an ancient history. This is 2007 that this had. This is like almost Twitter era, social media that this happened in. People don't even know. In Cosey Thondaway, I cite that one all the time. That's 2011 in Georgia, where he explicitly stated, racism is the reason that I am getting my gun and going to shoot and kill white people. That's 2011. It's tons of examples, more than you could. It's more time than we could even read in the book club of black people worldwide who have resorted to counter violence. That's just another one. That was why I included that clip. That's why I say learn local history. If you are in North Carolina, my goodness, you should know who. Make sure I get the names white. Willis Graves Jr., Ozzie Sweet, you should know. Who are these folks? How does this relate to racism, white supremacy? They were trying to solve the same problem we're trying to solve now. And you got another illustration of counter violence, black self-respect, black people who were not cowards. We've had that conversation about how do you nourish black courage. I think that's one way, making sure that, oh, no, you are not going to be one of those black people. If I have children or even myself, I want to make sure that you are not one of those victims of white supremacy who has been brain trashed, conditioned to think that black people are lazy and cowards. You are going to know lots and lots of examples of Black people who have fought back in a variety of ways, including counter violence. Next, if you're in North Carolina, see if you can catch the play. I'm going to see if we can get the guest on the program. Next, white validation. I thought of Thomas in New York so much when they had the segment on the book Farming that talked about the Black male actor. I would know I will butcher his name, but him growing to Europe and living with whites as kind of a foster victim of racism child, because that's supposed to make his life better. And then he didn't really fit in, going back with his Black family on the continent. And then he joins this white terrorist group. White validation. Wow. It's normally not intense, but I mean, that is frequently what happens. Seeking out, if I can just find some white people to accept me, if I can just find some white people to tell me I'm okay, if I can just find a few white people that are cool and they won't call me a kafir or a negro or any of the other names, at least to my face, that white validation. That is why Dr. Welsing talked so frequently about Black self-respect. That's why having the importance of knowing about, oh, wow, look at all these Black people who fought back. Like, wow, I'm a part of that tradition in trying to solve this problem by any means. Like, wow, I don't need to be with these racists. In fact, these are my enemies. I understand that I shouldn't be looking for companionship from them, even if I'm lonely. Black self-respect, grandsester, who mentioned CRISPR every time. That's why when they have information related to CRISPR, I play that sound segment. Dr. Welsing, in that segment where she's talking about gene editing, she's talking about Jennifer Doudna. That is the white woman who grew up in Hawaii around non-white people and thought of herself as a freak. You heard from her directly in that clip where she was talking about the application of the CRISPR technology to allegedly fight cancer and whatever else can be thought of. Same thing I'll say with the genetic testing. Frequently in the system of white supremacy, whether it's CRISPR, gene editing, or anything else, things are used for other purposes beyond what has been explicitly stated. I just think it's important to remember that all of the dialogue about CRISPR, the white woman who is regularly connected to this as the founder, that's what she said, and Dr. Welsing's interpretation of that and why she thought that was significant. She put it in the handout at the last Welsing Institute. Let's see. I spoke with a Cows listener before we went live. In fact, I can be explicit. I spoke with a Cows listener who thankfully extricated herself from a tragic arrangement, and the Cows was at least a little bit helpful in that process. Dr. Welsing's work was immensely helpful. Black self-respect, getting a correct understanding of things and moving towards safety. But spoke briefly, and she mentioned Jim Jones. The metaphor, don't drink the Kool-Aid, I think was mentioned on Workplace Racism yesterday. And I said, I suspect there are probably a lot of people who don't even grasp what that metaphor means at this point, because it's so far removed from the event and the details of that event are not talked about on a regular basis in 2020. And so that just can be another thing that can happen with metaphors. People might not even know the details of exactly what it is you're saying, which can sometimes erode the effectiveness of the metaphor in terms of people actually understanding what you are attempting to suggest or attempting to say. But Jamestown, Jim Jones, that is a great study in white supremacy racism. We've talked about that on the program many times. Lots of information at major institutions. If you go to university libraries and search Jonestown, I'm sure you will find some great books, a lot of information on white supremacy racism. Another reason right there why you don't want to be accepting or need of white validation. A lot of Black people seeking white validation. It's a sound clip. I think I got it. There is a sound clip where Black people said that they did not see Jim Jones as white. Oh, my God.
People's Temple really was a Black church. It was led by a white minister. But in terms of the worship service, commitment to the social gospel, its membership, it functioned completely like a black church.
He talked black. He really understood it. He understood how it was to be treated differently. And that's from his roots coming out of Lynn.
When people heard Jim, they didn't look upon him as being a white preacher, you know. People didn't look at Jim as being white. He was not white. He was just their preacher.
Context of white supremacy, been here a decade on the assignment. But yeah, there's a lot of information on Jamestown. I would suggest Dr. Welsing said study Nazi Germany. Absolutely. Study Jonestown, because she did. That was another one. I think Henrietta Lacks, that was something that she had a high interest in. Jonestown, Jim Jones, she had a high interest in that and talked about it regularly. I know she brought it up on the archives in her visit to the cows as well. But the danger, that was something she talked about, the danger. White people are so good at being able to fool us in this system. And with that white validation, a lot of dangerous things can happen. Continuing. I'll get the metaphors now that I'm there. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. Let's see. If things get really dark, that was mentioned in one of the closing sound clips and talking about the genetic testing. They had, oh my goodness, and talking about the school, that was the one. They said the anti-integration forces won. Now, I put that right up there with diversity crises, race relations, microaggressions. The anti-integrationist forces won. What does that mean? Do we mean the racists, white supremacists? Do we mean they were successful in making sure that the Negroes were not able to get quality education? That's a very different way of stating things as opposed to the anti-integration forces won. Words. It is the beginning of knowledge to call things by their proper names. So much of the system of white supremacy operates by using inaccurate words, deliberately incorrect language to describe what's being discussed. That is so much of how this system operates. Be mindful of, as I said, be ruthless about using correct terms. That is why the broadcast, the compensatory call-in specifically, I request that we not use metaphors. It is important to be able to train yourself. I can speak with precision, choosing my words, how I want to articulate myself with precision, and that way also listening so that I'm paying attention to how other people are speaking. Race soldiers, their primary method of terrorizing us and mistreating us is deception. Frequently, they will use these analogies and things, race relations, anti-immigration forces, diversity crises. They got more of them coming. They will use this sort of indirect language to confound what they're really talking about. They do this on a regular basis. Victims like myself, we've been exposed to this for centuries. And many of us, myself included, we are still learning. As such, sometimes we just haven't come to a conclusion on certain subjects. That's fine. But it does mean that sometimes we are missing logic to articulate ourselves. So we will sometimes substitute and use an analogy, a metaphor of some sort. Frequently, that just contributes to more confusion. If we could be direct, exact about what it is we're trying to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. It is important. If we could take about 5 minutes to share, if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, that would be great. If you have additional comments, just wait until everyone has had at least one chance to speak, and then you can, I'm sure you'll have time to share any additional thoughts. If you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. You can unmute when you're ready to talk, hopefully in an area that's not too noisy. And then once you're done, you can mute. That way we don't have to compete with a lot of rowdiness in the background. Just helps preserve the quality of the broadcast. With that, the number again, 605-313-5164. the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. We are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. We are also on Cash App, cash.app/$TheCows. Much obliged to all the folks who have supported us for a decade. I hope the program has been, continues to be, worthy of your time and energy. You can also invest by nabbing items from my Amazon wish list. Much obliged to all the folks who have nabbed items. This has been a horrendous week on the plantation. Like, wowee, if ever there was a need to explain why Gus T has said he is doing right poorly, this week is it. Like, right poorly from beginning to end. Threatened at Sunday morning yoga. That was a fitting omen for what was going to come this week. Like, woo. I didn't even eat Thursday. I mentioned that I fasted, not by plan, but just there was so much strife and turmoil. I didn't even get to stop to get a chicken nugget or anything. Just what an awful week. In fact, I can tell people it was so awful of a week on the system, on the plantation. I'd said, I think my headset is failing. I'm going to put a headset on my wish list, see if we have investors where I can get a new headset. That way I won't have any issues with the audio. I get the new headset. I'm all excited to use it. Looks great. Same brand I've been using for years. Pop it on. It feels outstanding. I'm all excited and gleeful. And then the microphone doesn't work. That has been the week for Gus T. Renegade. Nothing. Or I can't say nothing, but woof. Unpleasantness abounds, but that is the system. That is why we're trying to solve this problem. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, suggestions, questions, lines should be open. Proceed.
Hello?
Yes. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. This is D. Scott. I am calling in from North Carolina. And I've been listening to the show since about 2015. This is my first time calling in, but the show has played a great role in me being less confused as a victim of racism, and it also has been very constructive. If it wasn't for this show, I don't think my counter-racist IQ would be as high as it is now. Also, I was watching a show on ESPN, which since watching the show, I have, you know, greatly reduced the consumption, my consumption of watching television.
Oh, are you still with us? Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm still here. And it was they were having a conference and a talk, and it was
If you could, it sounds like you it's getting a little difficult to hear you. If you could make sure that you're speaking directly into your receiver, or if you could
hello?
That's much better. Yes, if you could stay right there, that'd be great so we can hear you.
Okay.
We could hear you. Now we can't hear you. We could hear you perfectly, and now we can't hear you at all.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yeah, and they were showing some of the non-white fathers of NBA players on the show, and they were talking about how they purposely, which I suspect racist, you know, purposely, you know, pushed the fathers to the background and portrayed the players as just, you know, their mothers being in their life and them looking like, you know, they just were raised by their mother, and these were fathers, you know, that had been in their son's life since they were born, and some even with the mother, and they never, you know, displayed them as much as they did the mothers. And I thought that was interesting, because I realized a lot of the ways that racists, you know, practice racism in sports, which, you know, I would subcategorize it under, you know, the people activity of labor. So, yeah, I just thought that was interesting. That's all I have to say.
Much obliged. First-time caller, North Carolina. Glad to hear the program has been helpful, hopefully, and you getting a better understanding of what white supremacy is, how it works, what we can do to solve the problem. Did you know of Ozzie Sweet or Willis Graves Jr.? Some black.
I've heard you mention them on the program in earlier episodes, but no, I haven't. I wasn't informed about them.
Right. We are all still learning. All still learning. I'm going to see if I can get the playwright as a guest on the program so we can all continue to learning. But much obliged, first time caller, for chiming in. Scotty Reed's North Carolina. Been there. Was there this year. I can't believe it. Rollsville. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments to share, you should be with us. Feel free. While folks are taking a moment to get their thoughts together, wanted to make sure Mr. Fox, the UK, I said I was speaking to a Cows listener just before we went live, and she was saying that just different topics or things that pop up, I'll just go on YouTube and do a little cow search, and boop, Mr. Fox has so much content there. I said, wow, time and energy, so important. Time and energy. He could have been doing lots of other things with his time and energy, but uploading the content there, it's been so helpful for people to be able to access the Cows at YouTube. Much obliged to Mr. Fox, years of dedication, investing in support of the program, hopefully helping folks also increase their so-called counter-racist IQ to solve this problem quickly, expeditiously. But much obliged, Mr. Fox, for sharing the content. Our iTunes feed should be working current, even though someone did tell me that the app was not functioning correctly. I checked like this week, and it seemed like the episodes were there, and they were playing in their entirety. So I'll check again. You can let me know if it seems like it's having trouble for you, but iTunes should be working, and updated Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, lots of different outlets to access the content for the Cows. Let's see. Other folks have comments, questions they wanted to make sure they get in. If you are with us, proceed. Grand, while folks are spectating, I'll make sure I get in. We should have Laura Wexler, white woman. She wrote A Fire in a Kingbrake. It is about the Moores Ford Bridge lynching, 1946, where they killed a pregnant black female, like super pregnant, but she should be coming to the program in a few days. If you want to read the book, that you can be prepped for her visit, and or you can study the Moores Ford Bridge lynching case so that you have a little bit more information about what happened with the event, why no one's been prosecuted more than 50, or at this point, more than 60 years after the murder. But she should be coming on the program. Always think it's grand. We get an opportunity to question white people about white supremacy, racism. And I think this Thursday, reading is more important than watching television. Make sure I echo that point. I think this Thursday, the book club might have to be an hour early because there is a book event. I will post it again. There is a book event in Seattle, and I am going. There is a black teenager who wrote a book. I posted it a couple weeks back. If you are in the Seattle area, you should come to Elliott Bay Bookstore this Thursday. It's at 7 p.m. And the reason I'm going is because it's a black high school student, no less, who wrote a book. His name is Azur Savage. And the book is You Failed Us, Students of Color Talk Seattle Schools. And he talks specifically, he uses the term white supremacy. I played a sound clip a few weeks back on the broadcast, and he talks specifically about white supremacy in the schools and how it keeps black students from the best classes, keeps them from doing their best at school. And that's what he wrote, You Failed Us. That's what it's about. And he's doing a talk on his book this Thursday at 7 p.m. At the Elliott Bay Book Company. I'm going to go. I might even try to record so I can play back, you know, what he says. And I'm going to see if I can talk to him to get him to come and be a guest on the program. But admit, yeah, all of that to say, because this event is at 7 p.m., I think the book club will have to be a little earlier, an hour earlier this week. That way we can do the book club and then I can go to the event. I think it's close enough. I have to look at the map again, but I think it's close enough that I can do the program and then run across the street and do the book event with Azur Savage and then share that later and let you all know how it goes. But if you are in the Seattle area this Thursday, black high school teenager writes a book about racism in the school. Excuse me, I use the word he used, writes a book about white supremacy in the Seattle school system. You bet I'm going this Thursday. If you're here, you should come hang out. I'll try to record. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, you should be with us. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Imhan DC.
Yes, sir. Greetings and greetings to everyone. I was still gathering my thoughts, but I will share what I've been thinking anyway and what I was wanting to say. One thing was I wanted to make a correction. I had mentioned about the Taurus 111, which is a handgun. I mentioned that it had a failure to fire that I observed in one of the reviews. And it was actually, it was another malfunction. But failure to fire is a specific term with a meaning that was different than what I was reading in the reviews. It was another malfunction. But I think that all black men should have a Glock 19. All black men should. I also think that, well, anyway, I was going to mention about the alliance that I've mentioned before that I want to be, that I would like to see between the Africans, all the Africans, and the black Americans, the black people of the world. I would like to see an alliance. And I don't know exactly what it means. I was talking to, you know, since I've been back from my last trip from Ghana, I've been speaking to some of the Africans I know here in my city and just talking to them about, you know, what are the possibilities of a unity of a unity between the black Americans and the Africans. And one of my Senegalese friends was saying that he doesn't know what unity means. And then I agree with him. I don't know exactly what it means either, but you know, the definition, what we've come up with is, well, actually I don't think we really got a clear definition as to what it exactly meant, except that we're trying to better both of our situations as groups. that we would like to see that, but we didn't know exactly how that would be possible. We mentioned blood ties or intermarriage. We mentioned land ownership, land allowances. If we were allowed to own land in America, we could possibly offer land, but we don't really have that particular piece of leverage or something to offer, that particular thing to offer. We can't really offer land. But we mentioned that land ownership between the parties would help with something similar to a unity or a united group. And also we mentioned, what was the other thing? Language. Actually, these are the things he was talking about. And so I thought it was worth mentioning anyway that, you know, there's people who are actually, excuse me, there are people who do want to see us get out. They want to see black people. How do I say? There are black people who want to work together in Africa and in America. We just don't know how to do it. We don't know how to do it. The other thing I wanted to mention was about the chemtrails. I talk about it a lot, but white people spray chemtrails every day. I saw one in Ghana. It was just one time I saw the long stream that, but I didn't see the plane, but I saw the long stream that wasn't a cloud. It was what I know to be a chemtrail or a chemical dumping from one of those specialized planes. And I took a photo of it, but it was just one time in Ghana. But I just saw it again here today in my city. And I also noticed that they do certain patterns. I've noticed this for a while, like they'll do squares, but it's not just any type of squares. Like, and then they'll go over the same, almost the same exact spot that they went the day before or the week before. And it's like, perhaps this is like where, I don't know if you've ever seen, you can put sand on a, let's say on a snare drum or on something like that, that type of surface, and then run a frequency through the surface of that snare drum or whatever that surface is, and the sand will form a pattern. And it to me, it looks similar to one of those patterns. I'm wondering if they're working on like the harmonics of like the natural harmonics of the earth. And I don't even know, you know, I have no clue, but they know how to make it propagate or how to make it like spread out. They know where to put those lines, and they know they aim for the sun whenever they're flying those specialized planes that dump chemicals, but they do it to make it colder. And that this is important because when they're talking about climate change is global warming. Global warming means the earth is getting hotter. Once the earth gets to a certain heat temperature, white people or albinos will start to die off in high numbers. Black people will die off in some numbers, but not in high numbers, not as much as what white people, how they're going to be devastated. But white people are talking about this, and they'll speak about it in their terminology of extinction rebellion. But listen to what they're saying. And they're even suggesting suicide. So don't get involved in these extinction rebellion type things. They're suggesting group suicides. And you just have to listen to certain people. But just be careful and know that, you know, the temperature, the planet heating up is not that much of a negative thing, in my opinion. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan Dc. That I love anytime people begin talking about unity. What do we mean when we say unity? And go from there. Like that's when we start to make sense, asking for specifics for details, definitions. And if we don't have it, then we can sit down and work it out. And then that should help right there. That should help us try to solve this problem and get better about quote unquote unity. And I think some of that is just about having a code, being more explicit with words. That can help a lot. Other folks who dialed in, the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. I'm looking at some of the different books on Jonestown. There are many, 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 even some very, very recent books, one that was published just last year, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple. They got Understanding Jonestown and People's Temple, lots and lots of books, DVDs, Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple, lots, lots of books. We should have Jonestown reading in the book club. I think that would be fitting. Dr. Welsing would approve, I think. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up and we have missed you totally thus far, if you have comments to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Salutations, Gus, and hello to everyone else on the line listening and participating. Mr. DC, I wanted to suggest maybe you look into the black, what is it again? The Black African Infrastructure Organization, or the BAIO. I had asked people if they had heard about it a while back, because I've been looking into it, and it's for non-white black people that want to expatriate to the continent. They're making some progress toward that and actually going on an excursion, I think, next year to Rwanda. Rwanda's being really built up, and you know, I'm not suggesting anybody move to Rwanda per se. Not that, you know, not that the stuff that happened there was completely, you know, at the fault of the Rwandan people, but, you know, it is being rebuilt and people are moving to various places on the continent and they're visiting various places. And I know that's one for sure that they're going to. And then I also wanted to ask you later on, maybe in the broadcast, if you could tell me what is a comfortable dollar amount to begin real estate investment on one's own without needing to get hard money loans or any other credit-based loans if the person has access to that type of capital. Let's see. The Army Art Task Force, in my opinion, it translated to steal more art. Because there's been such conversation about, oh, we're going to give these people their art back, and I don't know, I don't trust it. So it just sounds like another way to do the same thing instead of pillaging through the sake of archaeology. Now we can just say, well, you know, we don't want anything to happen to the art, so we're going to, you know, we're going to protect it, we're going to house it. There was a report, what was that? I can't remember which report, but, the guy in Britain. It reminded me of a young black male at a university event for non-white black males in high school that were considering going to college. The black male said that he was adopted, and his family, of course, was white, and he had no exposure to black people at all, so he felt awkward around them. He couldn't relate to them, but he also knew he couldn't even relate to his adopted family. I saw another report about that on YouTube with a grown, you know, an adult woman. She has, like, salt and pepper hair, so if you look for it, you'll know who I'm talking about. I don't know her name, but she said the same thing. She was adopted by a white family. She wasn't exposed to any black people whatsoever, so now she says she's, you know, ashamed to say it, but she's afraid of black people, somewhat being around them. She doesn't, you know, she's not comfortable at all, and she feels as though she wishes she had not been adopted. She said she would have rather had been with her mother, even though her mother was struggling financially. She said she would have rather that her mother kept her than give her up for adoption, and her mother also expressed having the same regret. And if I could do like the caller in Florida, I'd probably give this a label, racist isolation. And I did witness that today in the store, too. There was a white man shopping, and I saw him with a black child. Then all of a sudden, they weren't together anymore, and the child was looking for the man who actually continued shopping, so much so that he had actually placed his food on the conveyor. Then he stopped and was like, "Where is he? You know, let me go look." I said, "If you're looking for him, he's this way." "Oh, thanks." I'm like, "You should probably tell, you know, the front desk to page him to the front. That'd make it easier." He didn't do it. And it took him some while, took him a while to find that young man. And black adoptions by white people, in a way, is a sort of a tragic arrangement. Dermatologists and doctors in general are very used to treating non-white people with dignity and knowledge, it seems. I was misdiagnosed by a dermatologist who was non-white. He was Indian, Asian, and he kept telling me I had something I didn't have. He even did a dermatological puncture in two places in my skin, and because it didn't reveal what he wanted it to reveal, he continued to misdiagnose me, gave me antibiotics that I didn't need. I had to heal myself by going on YouTube and looking up black people with pityriasis rosea. And that is how I was able to find out I needed lysine, collagen, and one other supplement that I, vitamin C and D. And the last thing I want to say is I turned in a tort form and an incident report to the patient advocacy office at the VA because of the medical apartheid I experienced when they extracted my blood by fraud. And I made sure to cite the criminal activity by Johns Hopkins in regard to Ms. Henrietta Lacks. May she rest in power. I'm awaiting to hear a response, but part of my report was that I no longer want to be treated at the VA. I want to have all my primary care done by a non-white African-American woman who's down the street, and that should be a resolution for everybody, considering that I've had to make several complaints about what's going on there. And I'll end my turn. Thank you very much. Have a great night.
Wow. Although I am very sad that happened to you, nobody wants to be mistreated when they have when you're visiting for medical procedures. But that is the counter racist way, where you get to go on the attack, you get to file your reports, and boom, 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 just go right down the line, cite the evidence. Henrietta Lacks, again, I'm so glad we already read The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. I'd feel guilty at this point. Again, Dr. Well, I wish I had known that was one of her pet projects, because I would have brought that up immediately all the time while we were reading the book. But when you can cite and have references that this is repetitive racist behavior, these types of things have been consistently done to black people. And that's another reason why I would have reservations about all that DNA sharing, just the history of how they behave with our genetic material. But spectacular. If you could let us know how your efforts, if you are successful there. And I'm sure a whole lot of black people have had that same sort of callous treatment. The other, when you were talking about going for the skin issues and the non-white doctor, so-called Indian, him also being kind of rude with you and not helpful, ultimately rude and not helpful, where it wasn't, you know, coming out the way that he wanted to. Just one of the reasons we try to stay out of the hospital, if you can find a black doctor or talk to other black people around who can recommend someone. But man, medical apartheid, it is such a heinous experience for so many of us at a time when it should be, oh my gosh, this is so tragic. We're going to make sure you get the best care. You know, you're at least going to be coddled and lots of empathy and soothing, competent care. And that is just not the case at all under the system of white supremacy. Reminder for folks, if you can as well, to make sure you take someone with you who is well so that they can advocate on your behalf. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, think correctly well if you're not well. With the your commentary on the children and Tashi, the non-white female, being adopted and how that impacted her self-respect and being around non-white people, I think Dr. Welsing, she regularly talked about throwaway children, and she also talked about black self-respect being demonstrated in the act of procreation and just taking that really seriously, because that's something that for so frequently it is not planned, and the system of racism, white supremacy, pretty much everything should be planned and thought about well in advance. Like, we're in a system where you got Jerry Sandusky's racist school system. It's going to be so many things that are out to destroy, literally destroy your black child. This needs to be well thought out in advance. What are we going to do as attempted counter-racist parents for the next 20 years to offset what racists have planned for this child that we are thinking about bringing into the world? That's correct way of thinking to solve this problem. Not, you know, whoops, and now the child's here, and what do we do? And Dr. Welsing talked about that all the time. Black self-respect is demonstrated in how we go about the act of procreation. Much obliged, Irie. If other folks, comments, questions, number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, if you have comments, questions, suggestions you would like to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Greetings, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. Call you from cold and wet southern Florida.
Uh-oh.
Cold and wet. Feel like I should have stayed in New York. I think that the word pussyfooting comes from a football origin. I don't know. That seems to be a place where that word was used a lot when I played football, and it fit the context perfectly. And I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't taken from there and then added to the dictionary, like bling bling has been added to the dictionary, you know, it's the actual word. LGBT, I can't remember the question you asked, but I wrote an answer. White gay men are using white lesbian women and blacks to get civil rights. The LGBT movement that I see is part of the patriarchy white man system, same as heterosexuality. It's just they're using the women, I think, to get the power, and then they'll, you know, eventually be the people in charge, the white males, gay white males, rather. The black male father, his name's LeVar Ball. He has a son in the NBA, two sons playing basketball outside of the United States, one of whom is projected to be top five draft pick next year. He started his own sneaker line and basketball league for young males to get paid for playing ball as an alternative to going to college where they wouldn't get paid. And I think his actions, even though the white supremacists did everything in their power to make sure that both his sneaker company and the league was a failure that he created. But I think those actions were the catalyst to the NCAA claiming they want to pay the athletes now. I think that they realized that, you know, they were able to stop him, but if someone else tried with a little bit more backing, that they would have a harder time. So they decided to, give up. And that's what I think. Obama administration, Eric Holder led Operation Fast and Furious, also known as the ATF gun working scandal. Tens of millions of dollars of military grade and street ready weapons sent to Mexican cartels. Mexico is now a total narco state. The cartels have more power than the government. And the military in Mexico arrested El Chapo's son, and the cartel started, you know, fighting them, so they had to give them back to the cartel. It was things that you just wouldn't think of ever happening here. I do think that those white children and white women being killed in the crossfire with the current president, if this was to happen again, you could see United States military engagements in Mexico, not to fight war with the Mexican government, more guys that they're helping the Mexican government get rid of the cartels. But that could be, I saw the president, he placated on that during his speeches that he gave the last week. And he gave a speech yesterday to a bunch of black people where he was talking about some of his plans for black America and things he did. Either way, I do see that as a potential backlash from those white children and white women being killed by these Mexicans. 35,000 Klansmen in Detroit, I think the clip said. And I thought that was amazing, being that Detroit is a so-called chocolate city. Unfortunately, no need for Klansmen anymore. They have Project Greenlight in Detroit. They're ushering it out, and people don't need to do anything anymore. The technology will do it for them. Iraq and Syria, one of the clips said it was the cradle of civilization. That's only biblical. There's no science or art to confirm that. Look up Caral Supe, C-A-R-A-L /S-U-P-E. Some of the oldest artifacts of architecture in the world, mummies with locks down to their ankles, fully preserved, obviously black people. This was an article, Georgetown University of law privacy expert Claire Gavy put together a video that explains why you should be concerned about the growing use of facial recognition technology, even if you have nothing to hide. As Garvey puts it, Americans are basically in a perpetual police lineup. The digital equivalent of police walking through a crowd and yanking each of our IDs out of our pockets. You could be picked out, investigated, possibly arrested, sent to jail. That's a violation of your privacy, Fourth Amendment protection. Garvey outlines three aspects of facial recognition technology that concern her the most. How it's used is one, police violate our rights through process. Two is how it's manipulated. And three is it's biased. There's a significant higher chance technology will misidentify African Americans and other minorities. The facial recognition technology, which works almost 98% accurate on white people, is only about 53% accurate identifying black people. In fact, they put Congress people in the database, athletes, star athletes, and they were brought up on criminal, like they were people who committed crimes, and, you know, based off of the facial recognition, and when they put the two faces together, they don't even look anything alike. A lot of what they use to program this, white people use pictures of monkeys and apes and gorillas to teach the programming, the machine, how to recognize black people. So totally inaccurate, and it's going to be very dangerous. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you, guys.
Wow. Much obliged, Thomas. In New York, I looked at the online etymology site for pussyfoot. Now, check this. From 1903, tread softly. From pussyfoot as a noun from 1911, a detective, American English, from the nickname of U.S. Government Indian Affairs Agent W.E. Johnson, 1862 to 1945, in charge of suppressing liquor traffic on Indian reservations in Oklahoma, Mr. Fuller, who was noted for his stealthy tactics. So his nickname was Pussyfoot. That is amazing. Like, at least in my view, that a word like this, when the system of white supremacy ubiquitous in language, that even a word like this, that a part of the etymology to the earliest uses, or earliest noted uses of this word, and this could be inaccurate, still go back to racism, white supremacy. A white man who is nicknamed Pussyfoot for being so stealth with being able to maneuver on Oklahoma Indian reservations to stop liquor trafficking. Wow.
You know, that first definition you read, it fit, because when I played football, and they handed the football off to the running back, and he didn't run through the hole hard. The coaches say, you're pussyfoot and run through the hole, you know. Stop pussy, stop treading slow, stop, you know, go through there aggressively, you know, and so that's where it came up, but very interesting. Thanks for the extra detail, sir.
Words. Fascinating. Fascinating. Pussyfoot. All of that. It is listed as a verb. That's what they got up there. That's what I said last week. As a verb. Absolutely. Woo. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That is interesting about potential military intervention in Mexico. We'll have to think about that. Would it take another event? Have to ponder on that one. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, if you have hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everyone else. Jim Jones. I can recall as one of the most effective racists that ever lived. He is a excellent example of the idea of the understanding that white people cannot be ignorant about racism, white supremacy, and they definitely can't be, they definitely know a lot about non-white people who are racially classified as black. Mr. Jones took advantage of that knowledge and understanding and mistreated thousands of non-white people who are racially classified as black. Even the metaphor of drinking the Kool-Aid has something to do with what I just said, because I would factor that he understood that the financially challenged non-white black people that he ultimately mistreated, he used Kool-Aid, which was a popular drink for financially challenged non-white black people, to disguise the poison that he had in those cups that he was giving those people. And any information on that subject, in my opinion, would be appreciated to study about Jim Jones. I think I heard some talk about a book read on the subject. It would be welcomed by me, definitely, because it certainly is worth our time and energy to read and study on Jim Jones and how proficient he was in non-white people's behavior, and how he was able to negatively impact to death literally almost 1,000 non-white black people. I mean, get them passports, leave the area where they were at to go to a worse environment, and then was able to influence them to, in some cases, accept. Not all of it was accepting death, because a lot of people were willfully murdered by the orders of this person. But it'll be worth our time and energy, I think. I heard something about someone was interested in quote unquote an alliance between I think the term was called Africans. I'm not against it, so to speak. I would say some of the efforts in the past were not constructive. And in some cases, it ended in the death of a lot of people. But I would say that what would be constructive if the alliance and understanding, first and foremost, was predated by a code. Mr. Fuller is appreciated about his suggestions of a code, but he would tell you he didn't invent it. You know, it's basically something that is logical to do, because the force that is so prevalent in the world against non-white people, it is codified, and the people who enact racism, white supremacy are codified. So basically, the suggestion is to be counter-codified, counter-racist codified. And I would say that would be something constructive to develop or to arrange and or predate it before any non-white people physically come in contact with one another in something like a meeting or something like that. Then I would think it would make sense in that light. DCS meeting session was today. Primarily, we broke the group down into sections and basically conversed with the young fellows for a period of time. We also watched a segment of a documentary on the history of the Black Panther Party. That's it. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Lots of constructive documentaries. They even got quite a few on Jim Jones. That's where I got that sound clip from. PBS has a really good one.
Oh, yes, it is. A lot of Jim good information. Jones.
Mm-hmm. And more to come, it seems. That's a subject with lots and lots of archival material, video footage, especially if you live in San Francisco. I lived in the Bay Area for a few years, and I was not studying white supremacy racism at the time. I was super confused, but I did know about Jim Jones and did, you know, have a slight curiosity about that. And he was there in the San Francisco area. So they have a lot of information. Like, you can find all kinds of books, and you could probably go to the Berkeley Library, and, you know, people have written dissertations and what have you, in addition to all the books and articles and documentaries and all the rest. But I mean, lots, it's lots and lots and lots. And I mean, that right there is the same, as I said, the same way Dr. Welsing talked about Nazi Germany. They're doing all that talk this week about studying since the wall fell and 30-year anniversary and all that. The same way that she talked about studying Nazi Germany to learn about white supremacy racism, study Jonestown. That's a much more recent event. You could ask your parents same way. Like, if you have parents, if they are, what, 60s? I'd say anybody in that age range, like, oh, yeah, they should have been around, and they should be cognizant. They should be functional to say, yeah, do you remember the Jonestown event? Like, what do you remember what people said? Like, ask if you have relatives, anybody in that age group, 60 and up, I would think, yeah, they should be alive. They should be able to tell you a few tidbits about what was happening at that time period. That's a really important event. And Dr. Welsing recognized that as a really important event as it relates to whites. It's in the, I have to go back to find, we talked about that in the archives. Dr. Welsing talked about that right here. She talked about how significant it was. And this is what happens when you don't understand what it means to be white. She compared Jim, talk about comparisons and analogies. I believe she compared Jim Jones to Timothy, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Wise, what can happen when you do not understand what it means to be white, and how a slick talking white person, how much damage they can do.
The major media stayed away from the racial aspect. And if you didn't research it yourself, you would just say, well, okay, well, this is just one of these events, whereas some white minister was able to convince a group of people to brainwash them to be able to take advantage of it, and you know, a lot of people got harmed in that light, but it didn't have that much of a racial context to it at all, especially from you would have to have done your own research to find out that the overwhelmingly majority of these people who made up, I forgot the name of the organization that he called it, was non-white black people. You know, now he had an administration that primarily was white people. You know, and but most of the membership were, I mean, overwhelmingly, I'm talking about the 90 percentile, something like that, were non-white black people in areas in and around San Francisco area, stuff like that. You know, wow. Dr. Welsing was the first person that I heard speak on it in a more accurate term. And like you've been saying today, on a more direct term to, you know, what it is, in this case, the system of racist white supremacy. Yeah.
Absolutely. She would do that with Jeffrey Dahmer as well. Was just talking about him as well. That is another great case to study, which we have done. You can check that one off the cow's list. I just mentioned that today. Robert Dvorak, he is a white biographer of Jeffrey Dahmer. He was on the program in 2012. And it is not a coincidence, no such thing. He did a follow, or not a follow-up, but he did a book on Jerry Sandusky, the convicted child rapist pedophile, and he came back on the program. We talked about that as well, but talking about the racial dynamics to Jeffrey Dahmer, Mr. Fuller said that is the essence of white supremacy racism. That's who he points to. I just mentioned that before the program today, but we have already done our study. We had Dr. Welsing on and talked about Jeffrey Dahmer. Mr. Fuller gave his thoughts on Jeffrey Dahmer. That is already in the archives, case study of Jeffrey Dahmer as the essence of white supremacy racism. All of his victims, at least what's been reported, are males, I think exclusively non-white males. Might have been one white person when he first started out practicing, but like 90% of his victims, about 17, 18 of them were non-white males. Let's see. Other folks dialed in if you have commentary to share. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, everyone. I just have a question about the Jim Jones mass murder. Was Jim Jones getting victims from one main part of the United States, or were they coming from all areas of the United States? Was it like, I heard retired firefighters say San Francisco. Were most of the people from San Francisco, or were they just coming in from all parts of the United States?
I think I need to study more to know all of the details. I know Jim Jones resided in San Francisco. He lived other places, but he spent time there specifically as he was building the People's Temple and getting ready to go to Guyana, South America. I think, now I'm not an expert on this at all, but I think the black people that got there came from other places. Like, they were not just in the Bay Area or California. I think they came from way over. Like, he would travel around and get people in, like retired firefighter or other folks. Does anybody, am I talking crazy? Did the black people that got down there, did they come from all over the U.S.?
And the Caribbean.
And the Caribbean? Okay. Yeah, that's, I didn't think they were all isolated in one spot.
Okay. Thank you.
That's why we should do a book study on that, because I think that is worth, you know, trying to get as much detail. There are a lot of books, so it would, if anybody wants to make that a little pet project to kind of pick one that they think would be a good, I wish I'd asked Dr. Welsing, like, what's a good book you would recommend reading on Jonestown? But, oh well. If any folks make that a little pet project to sift through some of the books, and get one that has the correct racial context to it, that mentions, where did these black people come from? How did he come in contact? Like, give more of the details about this so we can get an accurate understanding. And with the and having the mindset that a lot of these books are not going to do that. So kind of go through and see, look at the language that's being used. Is this something where we can really learn and add this to our counter-racist understanding when we talk about this event? Make that a pet project to research a book we can read on. Oh, I think I do have one. I have to go back and check really quick, but I think I might have one. We'll have to see. But it would be great if we had options. So check, because there are lots of books on this subject matter. And if you find any good documentaries along the way on the subject, I guess you can share that as well. I already gave you one. The PBS documentary on Jim Jones is really good. I watched that when they made a sound clip. Let's see. Can I give you more than one? Already said Jonestown, the life and death of the People's Temple. Haven't seen that one. Oh, I did see that one. That's the name of the PBS one. Sorry. I'm still only got one. I'm sure there are others, though, because I bought one when I was in the Bay Area. They had them piled up at some of the independent stores there, and I'm sure they still do. There's probably even more of them now if they haven't put them all on YouTube or online. Yeah, I'll look through and see if I can find any others.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, retired firefighter. Oh, there's another one. There we go. Jonestown, Paradise Lost. There you go.
The founding place of his quote-unquote church was in Indianapolis, Indiana. And ultimately, he moved this quote-unquote church to San Francisco. Once he was in San Francisco, that's when it became, it started getting some national, some statewide, California statewide attention. And in turn, he eventually moved the church to Guyana. I mean, can you believe that someone was able to convince non-white black people to not only move from one place to another, in such a large scale. But like I said, get passports and move to another country and set up camp in the middle of a heavily wilderness area and build a quote unquote camp. That's how influential he was on non-white black people, meaning that he had a very deep understanding of racism and how to mistreat non-white black people by deception.
Hmm. So two books that...
It was in and around when I was in college in the late 1970s when this was taking place.
Hmm. So two books that caught my attention as I'm just kind of surfing through what they have at the library. Jonestown and the Manson Family, Race, Sexuality, and the Collective Madness. This is 1993. Hmm. That's worth a look. Next.
Hello, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Just give one more book title.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
We'll live. The next one is, was Jonestown a CIA medical experiment? A review of the evidence. Now, that one stood out. I'm going to have to go back in the archives. I'm a victim of racism. My memory is not as good as I would like. I believe Dr. Welsing said specifically that it was the CIA. She mentioned a specific government agency that was involved in obstructing autopsy information. Dr. Welsing was a medical doctor. She, this was one of her pet projects. I shouldn't say that. This was a incident of terrorism that she was especially interested in. She wanted to get access to the autopsies. You got a lot of victims here. As I say again, she was a medical doctor. She could not get access to that information. We talk all the time about withholding information. And I believe she said on the broadcast, or she did in a lecture, that the CIA was involved in suppressing access to those autopsies. That made her ask even more questions. Why would the CIA be involved in suppressing this information? You have all these deaths. Why wouldn't you want the public to know what happened? Make sure this type of thing doesn't happen again. Why would it be suppressing the autopsy, especially if it was suicide and gunfire? If we don't have any, you know, mysteries about what took place, why would there be some shroud over the autopsies? I have to go back in the archives to double check. But yeah, the two books that stood out, Jonestown and the Manson Family, Race, Sexuality, and Collective Madness. The other one was Jonestown, a CIA medical experiment, a review of the evidence. Irie, did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yeah, I wanted to say to retired firefighters, it's my opinion that a lot of non-white people could be convinced to leave their lives and go to remote places and follow a white man when they've been convinced that Jesus is white. And I also wanted to add about Jeffrey Dahmer, who absolutely makes me sick, no metaphor intended, but when I was living close to, you know, Milwaukee after the storm, I found out that there are tours conducted for where Jeffrey Dahmer used to predate his victims. And there are a lot of women, particularly white women, that are going on this, I guess you could call it, pilgrimage to where he used to live and where he used to go to attract these non-white victims. And I even saw a documentary on it later, and they asked the woman why she was going. She said basically she thought Jeffrey Dahmer was hot. She said she just wanted to give him a hug. That's all he probably needed was a hug and just love on him a little bit. So it makes me think of between him and this Jim Jones person, which I have to really look into now. My mom mentioned it once, but she didn't mention the racist aspect. But, you know, it's the Iceman inheritance, Urugu manifesting itself yet again.
She wanted the love. Love on Jeffrey Dahmer. I love it. No one wanted to love on Gus T at Sunday morning yoga, where I was threatened by tardy victims of racism. It wasn't, we want to love on you, Gus T. Make your Sunday a little better. Anyway, yeah, that I was just going to add a victim of racism off the air. Cal's listener was saying that a pal was trying to convince them to take a road trip to a part of California. They live on the West Coast, so this would not have been, you know, this would be like a drive, like a day drive to go to this part of California because they live on the West Coast. And like, I don't want to do it. Nah. The friend talked and 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 failed. And I said, now, wow, because I remember in this illustration, I used the comparison of Jim Jones. I said, now, think about that. Jim Jones was able to convince like hundreds of black people, may have been over 1,000, but I mean at least hundreds of black people to leave the continent for good. Like, and all their possessions, family, like for good. And signing over possessions, estates, money, all of that. Like, wow. And Jim Jones wasn't even their friend. This is just a white man that they met at church, not even their friend. They haven't worked together for years. I didn't grow up knowing your parents or anything. This is a white man I met at church. And now I'm leaving the country, got my bags. But where are we going here? Guy, what is it? I can't even say guy. I'm like, woo! The power of slick talking white people cannot, even on a small scale, because Jeffrey Dahmer, I know he had to do some talking. You see these non-white, he would go to the bar and stuff to get these people. They said on the Dahmer tour, the power of slick talking white people cannot be underestimated. I did want to stop because I believe I re-asked the question about investing for real estate, and I'm not sure if we got the answer, so I did want to pause to give Imhan DC an opportunity to. Did you hear the question from Irie? If you wanted to respond, sir.
Actually, I didn't hear the question. Oh. I was distracted at that moment.
It happens to the best of us. Can we maybe get a rewind on the question, please?
Yes. On the replay. So I wanted to find out if, or not if, what is a good dollar amount to begin real estate investment with, and I'll specify, in order to do a fix and flip, start doing that where I wouldn't need a hard money loan and I wouldn't need any credit relying or, you know, credit-based loans from any person or institution. So cold hard cash, that's a metaphor, pardon, but cash money, how much do I need to get in to buy into something like that?
Yes, ma'am. So I'm not an expert, but I can just tell you the information that I know. So the different real estate markets are very localized. Now, there is a, like, nationally, I can kind of probably guess the prices of a lot of the houses that are on different, or on markets, or on the market in different cities. I can probably guess a roundabout because I've done some studying, but I know Louisville, Kentucky, because I'm licensed in Kentucky, and I have joined a particular board of realtors. So I know the market here. So I can't really tell you, like, I'm not sure which city you're in. You could share that with me or not, but I would say, I could just tell you some of the things that were going on quickly, in Louisville, and maybe it'll help you out, but I don't have a, to answer your question, I do not have a dollar amount to tell you that this is the dollar amount that's a good investment where you won't have to get a loan, you know, or one of these subpar loans, or however you call them, the subprime loans, or some type of hard money loan. I can't really tell you what a dollar amount is. If I was trying to purchase real estate, I'd probably
maybe. I probably would stay around 30,000 myself, 50,000 myself in the area that I'm in, because there's some properties that you can purchase for a lot under that. And right now we're at like the top of, and what I see, we're at the top of, I guess the market. We're at the peak and now we're going down, but you can find areas that are going to maintain some type of consistency, even as the market start to crash over these next soon, these coming months and years. And so, but I don't have a dollar amount, and I'm trying not to be long, but I can say in 2008, when the markets crashed, a lot of houses were priced at $5,000. There was real good deals out here, $5,000, $10,000, some $20,000. These were awesome houses. And then once the market rebound some, you know, towards 2018, 2016, 2018, now into 2019, the houses, you know, it might be those houses that you could have purchased at 20,000, you might be able to sell it for 50-ish, or a little under, you know. But you know, it was some pretty big margins that, you know, you could have made some money if you had purchased back then. Now we're at the top of the market, so you're going to have to be high. I'm sorry to be low. Yes.
Thank you.
Grand. Well, spectating is not going to be rewarded today. So all of the people that have not spoken yet, the program is ending when it is supposed to end. You all that have not spoken, I will hush, proceed, but we are ending when we are supposed to end.
Can I be heard?
Heard everybody.
Yes, can I be heard?
Take the female caller first.
Hi, guests and guests and callers. I just wanted to make a comment in regards to what you were talking about Jim Jones. You guys were discussing different books, and I had been doing some research on the topic also. There was a book that I ended up finding on Internet Archives. It's called Raven, The Untold Story of the Reverend Jim Jones and His People. It's by Tim Ritterman with John Jacobs. It could be downloaded. Well, you have to borrow it off of Internet Archives. But it's pretty lengthy. I haven't had the opportunity to read the book yet. And also, I was doing some more research, and I found another book. It's called The Orphan Conspiracy, 29 Conspiracy Theories from the Orphan Trilogy. And the commentation is Jonestown member George Blakey, who was the chief aide to Jim Jones, was later identified as a CIA agent. Blakey purchased the land on which Jonestown was built. That, together with his CIA involvement and community's tragic end, could reasonably point to it being some kind of bizarre agency experiment. And he was saying that after the massacre, Blakey withdrew like $5 million from a Swiss bank account. He went to go reside in Trinidad. So he was actually a CIA agent, and he was inside. He was the chief agent to Jim Jones. So there were some ties to the CIA agency, and there were some other connections also.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Yes, ma'am. Was that it, or did you have?
Yes. I was just I heard this funny sound in the background. I wasn't sure what that was.
Much obliged, Draftomania. Got the book title. Others that we missed totally.
Gus, may I have your head?
Yes, sir.
Gus, I want to say I'm very sorry for what happened to you on Sunday with the experience with the with with the lady, man. You know, you don't deserve that. You're a good dude. Anyhow, I wanted to tell you about another person that's kind of that fight back. Was a guy by the name of Mark Essex, and it was in one of your archives when I read upon him, and he fought back because they were practicing racism, white supremacy against him in the Navy, and he killed a couple of people down in New Orleans. So for anybody who didn't access the archive years ago, it's a good write-up on him. And that's it, Gus. And you have a good weekend.
Much obliged, good sir. Unfortunately, Mark Essex did kill some black people, too, which generally happens. Christopher Dorner, even the counter-violence, which should not happen, according to what Mr. Fuller said. But yes, Mark Essex, New Orleans, Black Panther Party. Other folks, we missed totally. Did we nab everybody? Did we get everybody or anybody we missed completely?
Hey, Gus, I think you could add to the list of Jim Jones and Jeffrey Dahmer's unsuspecting white people. You could add Dylan Roof to that list. You know, black people were so happy to have this young white man in their church that they put their guard down. And as far as the CIA being involved in Jonestown, I've also heard that as well. Also, I've seen a lot of evidence to show the CIA was involved in the Atlanta child murders as well. I mean, it's a lot of things that they're involved in that pertain to black. In fact, I think even you have Tatasha on the CIA was involved in, you know, looking into a lot of COINTEL on black people as well. So they're always around, you know. It is what it is. But either way, Gus, great show. Thank you.
Much obliged. They have an article. This is not a book. Oops, page jumped out. Kool-Aid and the Jonestown Tragedy by Alan Johnson. That's a lot. Depends on how much, you know, how much free time you got. Seems like there's a lot to research. Last 2 minutes. Any, if the folks we missed totally, if you have something you can share in 2 minutes, or if anybody else has something they need to get in about 2 minutes, we're ending when we are supposed to end.
Hey, Gus, if you do a book, it would be great to have a book where the author could come on and talk about it, you know, hopefully a white person.
That would be nice to talk to a white person about. It seems like there's so many books, it shouldn't be too difficult. If we do that, then we should do a book on the book club so that we're all more informed on the subject, and then the white person can come and we can ask better questions and, you know, all that. Wow. So much information. That's what I said it's supposed to be like. White people spend a lot of time talking about this. We had a black male guest on the program, I believe 2013, 2014. He lived in South America, in Ghana specifically. And he lived there at the time that Jonestown happened. And we asked him about that, like, you know, what did they see? How was this reported locally? I remember we spent quite a bit of, that was like the first chunk of the program. Like, we were supposed to talk about other stuff, but I just, in the course, like, oh wow, you were there then, like, hey, we should make sure to nab that. Like, y'all have to post that, because I did think that was a good find. I'll assume folks are satisfied, nobody spoke up, so we will be back. Check Black Talk Radio Network Facebook for the upcoming broadcasts, the book club, Paul Robeson part 3, I think we're at, chuckling on moving on through the book. Part 4, sorry, we already did 3 segments. Part 4 coming up this Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I am teaching yoga Sunday afternoon. If you're in the Seattle area and want to come hang out and do some yoga, let me know. Can give you the information. I do think the book club, Paul Robeson, it will be an hour earlier so that I can attend the Elliott Bay book event. We might even have to be like a little more than an hour. Like, might have to be like 70 minutes early so that I can have time to run to the bookstore so that the white people don't gobble up all the seats, so that I can get a nice spot up front, ask my question, and see if we can get the author on the program. But that is for Thursday. I will let you all know how it goes. Hopefully I can record at the event. Anywho, much obliged for everyone participating. I hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's do all we can to keep our brain computer working optimally so that we can solve the problem promptly. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up. We want to minimize contact with the Daniel Holtzclaw and Amber Geigers of the known universe. Buckled up whether you are driving or a passenger. If you are driving, you are buckled and your cell phone is parked. Again, just trying to do all the little things that we can to stay as safe as we can under conditions designed to be unsafe for black people. Creator, it has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect each and every time we are in contact with another black person. White validation is not needed. Help us to cleanse the desire, the need for white validation. Help us to recognize that is part of our brain trashing. Cows signing out. Much obliged for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.